This may make for some fun later. Or a real snooze. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sneaky Dragon. I'm Ian Boothby.
And I'm David Dedrick.
Let's do this again. This is episode, I had it written down and then it went away. 670, again.
670?
No, wait, is that wrong?
We missed the Christian Nansen
640.
Show? Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
We've leapt into the future. Some sort of time bubble enveloped us and brought us forward into time.
We did the 12th anniversary of the Critical Hit Show yesterday, and more than one person thought it was the 20th anniversary. So we're aging terribly.
Pandemic stretched time so much.
Sure, let's do that. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. But yeah, we had our 12th anniversary show yesterday, which was fun. But sorry for pushing us too far in the future. Would we be too... Oh my gosh, I'm trying to think how many episodes that would be. Well, it would be easy to do simple math on that. Now that I feel bad. 30. It would be 30, right?
What,
30.
Sorry, what did we think? Sorry.
It would be 640 plus 30 would be 670. So
yeah.
I pushed us 40 weeks into the future. Past Christmas. Yeah. I wonder how our Christmas was. Hope it was nice. And sure you're right. It is past the question show. Our question show is always like at the 50 episode mark. So for episode 650, we answer any questions you send us. And mm-hmm. we mean any questions you send us. In the past, this has led to very, very long podcasts. And we're older gentlemen now than we were back then. I don't know if we can handle it, but we'll try our best.
We'll never break the record, because the record was like you and I talked for over 4 hours, and then Mary and I did a supplementary question answer music related one.
Oh, for Sneaky Dragon listening party?
No, it was for Sneaky Dragon.
Why?
I think you were just like, I'm done.
I'm done? Yeah. After 4 hours? Was it that you found an extra stash at the last second?
No. We decided to do two separate ones just so that the music questions would be like
for Mary. Was that because your music answers are insanely long?
Probably.
That does make sense. Okay. Fair enough. It is like a thing like if you ask a question about the Beatles, there we go. You have time to watch a couple of Beatles documentaries by the time you wrap that up. And that's not bad. You're thorough. And there is definitely an audience that is for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
People love the Beatles.
People love details. Like I will listen to, you know, a multiple hour podcast true. On comedy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'll listen to that.
Yeah.
You know, I just listened to like about 8 hour long books on comedy in the last month. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm down with that. I listened to one from Cliff Nesteroff. I listened to one from who's the sort of mean sarcastic British fella, Jimmy Carr. I listened to a bit of the Jimmy Carr, and I listened to Jesse Fox's
all of them.
All his books?
No, the British. Mean.
Yeah, there is a sizable amount of mean British people. I say mean, in real life seems nice.
Yeah, but just their persona is
a shock comedian.
They like to, that's what they like. They like to be pointed.
There was a discussion like a stick. I was listening to with Jesse Fox, who hosts a podcast called Good One, and wrote a comedy book called Comedy Book, about comedians that... changed over time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting because he was discussing an episode of the television show something up there, it's up dangerous up there. Oh, up there, watch it up there. What? It was the one about the comedy club. It was basically the Comedy Store.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, based on
I'm
dying up here. Hey, easy up there. And it was an episode where a comedian from the 50s, because it's set in the 70s.
Yeah.
So a comedian from the 50s tries to play the club and is booked and bombs.
Yeah.
And a comedian who is like the hot comedian of the 70s mm-hmm. says to her, oh, I really liked your act. And she went, you shouldn't, because you're the present. And I'm really here to be the shoulders that you stand on.
Yeah.
And you're the shoulders that the next generation will stand on, and that's the way this works. Mm. You shouldn't be admiring my work.
Yeah.
But I am, but, you know, and it was like, oh, that is true. And the only way that that would work, where you would like a comedian from the past and the present, is if they evolve.
Was that episode called The Not Marvelous Miss Maisel?
Possibly. I don't know. You'd have to ask Jim Carrey, who was one of the producers.
Jim Carrey was a producer, though.
Of that, okay. Yeah. And so they were talking about comedians, and the obvious ones were George Carlin, who yes. went from, you know, kind of, you know.
A few phases during his career, yeah, for sure.
Right, and Richard Pryor.
Okay. And, I mean, these are almost unfair in a way because.
How so?
Well, because all of them started in the 60s when it was very buttoned down, you know, Mort Saul, Bob Newhart inspired. And so everyone, whether they're Bill Cosby or Richard Pryor or George Carlin, all started in that period with a tie and a shirt and stuff like that. And then
right.
then the 60s happened and they all kind of let their freak flag fly.
Well, did they all? I mean...
Bill Cosby, not so much, but, you know, Richard Pryor certainly...
Bob Newhart didn't? Mort Saul remained the same? No, I just mean,
I mean, the guys who changed, though, like, yeah. there's a sea change that they could definitely follow
oh,
along
sure, sure.
with, you know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean...
Because in a way,
when you're saying
impressive.
It's not fair, adjusting to the era that you're in,
yeah, yeah.
This is actually exactly what we're talking about, is the comedian from the 50s yeah, would have had to have yeah. adjusted to the 70s, mm. and she had no ability to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in modern times, one of the people they brought up, which I agree with, is Sarah Silverman, who I'm bringing up because of the Jimmy Carr thing, where Sarah Silverman used to be a shock comic
yeah.
who did a character and over time became herself on stage mm. and really radically changed the style that she did. She still does shocking material, but it's not ironically distant material.
Yeah.
You know, she still does jokes, mm. But yeah, totally changed with the era that she's in.
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird watching I watched like an episode of Family Guy from about 15 years ago, and it was just, whoa, okay, this is so of that era, so of the mean era, like
yeah,
where there
yeah.
was an opportunity for a mean joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a racial joke, or a gay joke, or a trans joke, just full on in.
Yeah.
And that's changed over time as well, because now is now. Can you think of any comedians that have changed in their style?
Over time?
Mm-hmm. I mean, Steve Martin has a very different persona now than
that
he
would
did
be,
back
yeah,
in the day.
He would be a good example. I think he'd be an example of that. But I mean, once again, he's not really a stand-up anymore. You know what I mean? Like, he kind of quit being a stand-up and started a movie career. And that definitely allowed for him to change as a persona.
Though he does a two-hander with Martin Short.
He does.
Where the two of them come out
he
and
does.
They do comedy.
Sure.
So he has enough... He does monologues in that.
Okay.
Or he also does stuff sometimes on Saturday Night Live where he'll do a monologue mm. or something like that. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just think that having the break of like a whole movie career, it does allow you to change without having to like, you know what I mean? Like he didn't have to reconfigure his act or anything. He just kind of like stopped. He stopped.
Right.
And, you know.
Though I do feel when he's doing comedy, he's doing the same thing which he used to, which was, what is stand-up? I'm going to do a parody of stand-up mm. more than doing stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, he knows what stand-up is now and will, you know, counter-program his act to be an alternative to that.
Sure. I mean, a comedian, this is an older comedian, but someone I think that changed, and when they did change, they were pioneering in their change. They weren't following the trends, which would be Lenny Bruce. I think he, you know, kind of brought alternative comedy, you know, to his own, you know, it hurt him, but mm-hmm. he definitely was like someone in the forefront of that who started as like a pretty, you know, so-so kind of Catskills style comedian, you know, doing impersonations and just doing, you know, jokes everyone else was doing. And then like many comedians, I think George Carlin had this too, where he basically like quit for a while and then came back radically different. You know, like he was part of, what are they called? Burns and Carlin and Burns. Anyway, he was with Jack Burns. He and another guy did a two-hander, as you call it.
Shriver?
Like, no, it was Burns. Jack Burns, I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Not Avery Shriver, yeah.
Okay.
But, and then, you know, he quit that act, kind of went away for a little bit and then came back. And then he remade himself again, in a way, because he when he came back, he was sort of still kind of pretty straight. He had short hair, you know, did the Ed Sullivan show and stuff like that. It wasn't until the late 60s that he started to grow his hair out and grow a beard and then change again. And then he changed even more, you know, later on he changed again when he started doing the specials in the 80s, 90s, where, you know, it became more, less joke, and more kind of like these sort of built monologues, you know, built around an idea.
It's hard to find Burns and that isn't Burns and Allen. Yeah, then we get into a whole bunch of different businesses.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it was Jack Burns that he worked with for a long time and then broke that act up and, you know, just kind of saw the writing on the wall and changed, you know. Whereas I think Lenny Bruce just got bored. And then because his career was going nowhere, he started like emceeing in strip clubs where most of his jokes were like for the band. Mm-hmm. You know, and not so much for the audience that wasn't really listening to him. You know, the long raincoat guys didn't really care what jokes he was telling on stage, and so most of his jokes were for the people behind him. You know, and that kind of opened him up, though, to allow him to like go, oh, this is kind of cool, like just sort of improvising on stage and be, you know, just kind of jazzing it up in a way. You know,
yeah. I'll go. You know, I mentioned Jim Carrey earlier. I'll say him. Yeah. He was someone who used to basically be an impressionist, mm-hmm. and would come out and do kind of the stunt stuff. And then he threw all that completely away and just started building an act from scratch.
Yeah. I was going to mention him too, because as someone who's a modern example of someone who, yeah, did the same sort of thing where you, and then kind of went away for a while too, because they were basically just sort of working in clubs, just doing weird stuff. You know, like there's images of him doing like kind of weird physical comedy on stage that makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
But just in the moment, he's just kind of letting his freak flag fly. And then, you know, and then kind of built that up into an act that he could then take out and bring to the public, you know.
And then became the thing in movies. Mm-hmm. And so how do you do comedy when you're the thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the tough bit. For a while, like Zach Galifianakis was a bit of that. Mm. He was like, you're the thing. You're basically the equivalent of Jack Black.
Yeah.
You're our new, that you're the scent, you're the lovable, you know, kind of non-sexual person. We can maybe give you a little bit of a romantic plot as long as the woman is you know, kind of goofy a little bit too, then we're all right with that. But we're not going to give you a straight love interest, and we're definitely not giving you a sex scene. But you know, you'll be the lovable kind of goof, and there you are.
But he morphed that too, because he did like the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and stuff like that, where that's not a goofy.
No. No, every step of the way, he has tried to undercut the thing that people expect him to be.
Yeah.
Even Cable Guy was not what people expected.
I've never seen Cable Guy, to be honest.
Oh, okay. Well, you can just watch the commercial. Then they did a, you know, not remake commercial, but brought the character back for a commercial recently.
Mm.
And I was watching Howard Stern interview Ben Stiller about that, because he's the director of Cable Guy, and asked, like, so were you involved with that? And he went, no, I found out about 2 days before it aired. And saying, like, isn't it weird people like it now? No, it was good. It was just not for the time that it was in, and it wasn't what people wanted from Jim Carrey at the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, we expect this from you. Oof. Okay.
Yeah, I've never seen that one. I should watch it, obviously.
But I think someone like a Zach Galifianakis is in a good place, because, you know, if he needs to, he can be the broad comedy type. Or if he did a dramatic role, you'd buy it too, because he's got so much pathos to him. So, yeah.
I haven't heard his stand-up for a long time, so I don't know if... I'm sure it's changed. I
mean, he used to be available for $5 in Vancouver.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, just a couple of streets over, pretty regularly.
Sure he was.
Yeah, when he was here with... True Calling, I think, was the show
he was on. With Eliza Dushku.
Right. And
Faith from Buffy.
He referred to it as truly appalling instead of True Calling. But, you know, pays the bills.
Yeah. I mean, he did it. No one put a gun to his head, I don't think. I didn't see one anyway when I watched the show.
Did you ever see his talk show?
Between Two Ferns?
No. His real talk show.
No.
He had a real, it was like something with Zach Galifianakis. But yeah, it was a straight talk show with some comedy bits, but okay. It was on either MTV or some similar situation. Didn't work at all.
No.
Yeah.
Because his personality doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, geez. I mean, David Letterman had one of the most successful, you know, talk shows ever. And you don't think his personality works that way. And never really did.
Prickly character.
Yeah. That's the guy you want to have interviewing people night after night. That guy. Okay. Whatever you say.
But in his defense,
Conan O'Brien.
He did officially get to the clip that they brought, you know, which is basically why they're there, to show their clip. So if you as the host get to the clip, then you're doing your job, I guess.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he got to the clip on the morning version of his show, and people went, "Oof, yeah, no, this is not what we're looking for."
That was definitely a show for people to watch in their, I don't know, their frat houses or late at night, sneaky downstairs, like some people, no names mentioned. That squeaky fifth stair in my house.
Yeah, I loved Letterman's like late night show. The Late Show didn't really do it for me. No. And then it was interesting seeing Conan O'Brien take over and go, okay, oh, he's not doing that well. But when he does do well, it's really good. So it's like these little bursts of, you know.
Oof. Yeah.
And that's just interesting. Like, there's so few shows that will give someone a chance to be interesting and learn as you go.
Yeah.
You know, with the exception of maybe Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, that's about it. There's not many, I mean, most shows have an idea of polish to them.
Yeah.
But.
And Saturday Night Live will give you a couple of chances before, you know, well, that's enough. That's not working. But, you know, lets you find your voice.
I wonder if that's because Lorne Michaels is from a different generation and grew up with live TV and just, you know, and just has no problem with the idea of, like, you know, spontaneity and possible disaster and all, you know, all the things that are part of that.
Well, that's, you know. I wrote a little about this on the No Man page on Facebook, but okay. Like, I honestly believe, you know, when people say, Saturday Night Live's not as good as it used to be. Mm. And it's like, you know, the sketches don't land for the most part. I was like, okay, but they never did. You know, no, if you look at like any one of them, it was hit and miss. You remember the great ones. You remember the bombs.
Yeah.
And aside from two seasons, one season being the scene where the new cast came in, the Gilbert Gottfried cast, where it just consistently tanked.
Yeah.
And the year that like Martin Short was on, where it felt like it was mostly characters that were already established.
Yeah, it was like a lot video. Of old pros came in and brought their box of tricks with them.
And they were brilliant, but, you know, safety nets galore. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, then it's usually like hit or miss. And I think that's the strength of the show, is it's interesting.
Yeah.
And interesting will last longer than funny, you know, consistently funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you gotta take some risks. People will watch. Oh, that didn't work. Well, you're gonna still watch the next sketch then.
Yeah,
because oh wow, where's this going?
Well, that, and I mean, there's an incredible amount of work there. I mean, an incredible body of work behind Saturday Night Live now. Like, just you think how long it's been on the air. Like, I'm sure you could put together like a pretty strong case by going year by year and pulling the strongest sketches. You could definitely make a case for like how great the show has been throughout its history.
Right, but you want to, like,
you're ignoring Cheeseburger. You're ignoring, you know, like, you're taking away, like, the ones that are obviously clearly boring. And for me, like, I saw SCTV before I saw Saturday Night Live.
Right.
SCTV was available on daytime television on Saturdays, whereas, you know, Saturday Night Live, I had to, you know, my parents were either had to be, like, unconscious for me to get downstairs to watch it. And just, you know, or when I slept over my friend's house, it wasn't until, like, I would have been past grade six that I started being able to see Saturday Night Live. And it was still early on, it was still the original cast.
Yep.
It was just later on in that thing. And there was funny stuff to it, but then there was also the cheeseburger sketch, which is interminable and only sticks in my mind because as a kid, it was so boring. You know, whereas SCTV seemed so sharp and fast and quick and funny and, you know, everything it was about things that I knew because it was all parodies of television, which I watched, and I knew what they were referencing. Whereas Saturday Night Live was very esoteric.
After they got past their Second City sketch pile,
sure,
that they went like, okay, we're just going to put these on TV. They don't work on TV. Okay, so just start writing new stuff for TV. That's way better.
But they kind of shuffled that into the TV parody bits as well, though. Even though when they're using some of the obviously stage bits that they would kind of present as a TV show or whatever, there was also like the little kind of cutaways to, you know, the Magnum PI parody with Sean Candy or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm sure with So when I saw Saturday Night Live, it just seemed very long. Like everything seemed so long, like too long, you know. But yeah, it's weird. So I must have seen the Albert Brooks stuff in reruns, because I do remember watching those, but I must have seen them in reruns.
Yeah, there's a. I mean,
that was only the first year that he was on
the Albert Brooks stuff. They had commercial parodies from the start that were video.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the sure thing was the music. Was like, you know, Paul Simon's going to be great for two songs. Sure. So here's, you know, I mean, that's going to lift everything up.
The sure thing was Mr. Bill. That was the sure thing.
Was it?
Oh, Mr. Bill was great.
Okay.
You know, you never saw Mr. Bill?
I've seen it. I was aware of what it was before I saw it. Yeah, so yeah. I never had the full impact of like, well, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it looked to me as like, oh, it's a Clay Super Dave Osborne thing. It's fine.
Sure, but yep. It was before that. So, you know, I wasn't comparing it to something that didn't exist. You know, I was just watching it for the time. And, you know, and it's quick and violent and fun and it's over. You know, it doesn't go on forever. Although I do remember really enjoying the Bill Murray lounge singer bit that he would do. That was great, I thought. And that I saw before Rick Moranis did his parody of it during the American anthem.
Mel Torme.
The Mel Torme. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early? Pardon me, boy. Is that Chattanooga Choo Choo? I don't know why I remember it still.
Yeah, no, I do that.
For all these years later, I can still remember.
Not a nickel too tall and tan and young and lovely. The girl from Ipanema. There's girl from Ipanema. Trying to find that last week. Yeah, it's fantastic.
It is a great bit. But yeah, and the Bill Murray one was good, but also long. It was also another long one. And I guess, you know, the longer they were, the more people could get changed and get ready for the next bit.
And you don't have to build two sets.
Yeah, that's also a thing. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Because one of the things that I, you know, and I wish I've kind of stopped listening to Fly on the Wall.
Me too.
Because it's a very frustrating show.
Yep.
And they got worse. They didn't get better. They got worse as it went. Like in terms of like endlessly talking about themselves and talking with each other. Excluding the guests. It just got worse. It just got worse and worse. They never went, oh man, we need to like focus on the guests.
It's interesting, but it also feels like a psychological experiment.
Could be. But what I wish they would bring on the show is some backstage people and talk to them about, not just talk to all the celebrity people they know, but also talk to like people who were behind the scenes. Like, what was it like bringing sets in an elevator that were built upstairs down to that floor and then having to like bring them down the hallway and get them ready for the show? And where were they stored? And how did they do set changes? I'm really curious about those sort of things. Like the actual like day to day, whatever the word is for like, you know, figuring out how you're going to like, do your lighting, get cameras moving around, and how you're going to build sets over here while stuff's going on over there, and just all those little bits, you know, that, and it's funny, like, comparing it to, and I mean, it's a little unfair, because Dark Shadows, which basically was shot live every day, it was shot to videotape, but it was shot live, but, you know, there's coughing, there's things being dropped in the background, there's cutting to a camera that isn't ready. There's the clear sound of people running to get to another set. Just all kinds of things that are happening that you don't really get with Saturday Night Live. You know, for all the liveness of it, it's actually a really smooth operation.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, sure, sketches might suck, but there's never a time where they arrive on stage and the set isn't there. Or you hear something fall over, or, you know, there's like the sound of things
that
being pushed.
That is interesting that in 40 years... That has more than 40 years.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened.
Yeah.
That a set hasn't fallen over.
Yeah. Or something that, you know, like it's always really well put together.
Here's
a
weird thing. 40 years, no one sneezed.
In the background?
No, at all.
Yeah.
Like
on set. Yeah.
On set.
Yeah.
Like you got 40 plus years, like 48 years, I think at this point, of actors on stage.
Yeah.
Performing.
Yeah.
For 90 minutes.
Yeah.
No one's ever sneezed.
Hmm.
How? Why is that?
Yeah.
It's bright lights. Why is no one sneezing?
Why
is no one in the audience sneezing?
Guess not.
What's
looking
happening?
At them. Well, hopefully not looking at bright lights while they're...
Yeah.
Who are they, Trump?
No one's coughed.
Yeah.
No one's done the... Anyway.
It's hard to know. Maybe it's not live.
It is live. It's live.
I've
watched it in...
I'm shrugging like
I've
conspiracy
watched,
theory shrug.
Well,
like,
you
don't know for sure.
I kind of know for
you
sure.
You haven't been to Area 51. You don't know what's there.
That's true. I did watch it in New York, you know, live. Not the live taping. I did watch it, like, on the camera. I guess they could have shot it minutes before. But someone would have spilled the beans.
Yeah, there is a delay on the show.
Well, yeah, there has
to be.
Because
they have the swear bear delay.
Yeah.
But, so maybe that's also a cough delay. Could take out sneezes, coughs, and stuff like that if they have to.
Well, maybe. I don't know how they do it, but okay.
I mean, if they can have 7 seconds to take out a swear word, they can have 7 seconds to mute a cough.
Yeah, so, yeah. I always used to think that about news broadcasts. You never see a news broadcaster sneeze.
Mm.
How? Why don't they sneeze?
They have cutaways, I guess.
But, like, while they're in the middle of a story.
Take it away, Tim.
Yeah. Is there something about sneezing where, like, if you're in the middle of something, you won't?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, it's very... And here's the other weird bit. Very rarely does I can't remember any time where I've seen talk shows where the host clearly has a cold.
Yeah.
And they're trying their best to get through. I've seen that.
Yeah.
I've never seen that with Saturday Night Live. I've never seen that with, like, any of the cast members. And maybe they would replace the cast member.
Yeah, that's possible.
But yeah, come out and, like, have a little sore throat or be a little off.
Mm, mm, yeah.
Weird. How's that? What's going on? Tell me.
We need some behind the scenes fly on the wall.
Yeah. Also, that much cocaine and no nosebleeds. Pretty amazing. Well done. We used to have the Paul Anka show here, and you would see that people had used some cocaine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's some shots of Paul where he's got a little mustache, and it's not milk.
What I love about there's a movie, The Last Waltz. And in that film, I think they've digitally removed these things now. But if you watch the original movie, there's a scene where Neil Young, who shortly before doing this movie, by the way, because I think it came out in 76. So shortly before that, he recorded his excoriating album, Tonight's the Night, his comment on the tragedy of drug and overdose and stuff like that in among rock musicians of that time period. And then there he is at The Last Waltz with this giant chunk of cocaine in his nose while he's performing on stage, which I think they have taken the trouble to digitally remove now from the movie. But
I'm going to tell you this.
But, you know, cocaine is different than heroin, guys.
Yeah. And we're going to prove it right now. Dave has two vials in front of him. He doesn't know which is which.
I don't know which is which. Am I snorting them?
Huh? Oh, well, I was going to say freebase, but, okay. You know, whatever you want to do. Yeah. The other day, we got into a discussion with somebody about...
Was it me?
No, it wasn't. Oh. But it was about that time where you had the, Do They Know It's Christmas song?
Yeah.
And then We Are the World.
Yeah.
And Tears Are Not Enough.
Is that the Canadian one?
That's the Canadian one. Better than the other two.
Tears Are Not Enough is better song?
Infinite.
Written by David Foster,
I'll tell you. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
You try listening to the other, like, first of all.
I agree with you.
Do They Know It's Christmas? Also, just the lyrics are just like, what are you thinking? Tonight, thank God it's them instead of you. What? Why would God? There's so much wrong with, like, oof. And then you get into We Are the World, and it's so American and so arrogant. And then you get, if you ever see, like, the making of, like, Tears Are Not Enough, everyone's charming. Everyone's real low-key charming. Yeah, sure. And also, you just like all these Canadian performers so much.
Yeah.
You're just like, aw. And there's one point where, like, Neil Young is doing his thing. And, and the guy's, can we just take it a little bit down from that high pitch? And he's like, that's my style, man. Like,
that's great.
Oh, Neil. That's great. He's so sweet.
So it must have been. I'm just imagining that song was written by David Foster, though. That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
These are very good questions that you're asking.
I mean, I don't know. I wasn't.
I want to say Bryan Adams.
I wasn't there at the time. Well, it might have been Bryan Adams. Bryan Adams probably had a hand in that. That was during that peak of his career.
Yeah. Okay. Songwriters. Yeah. David Foster, Bryan Adams, Jim Vellance.
I was going to say Jim Vellance. He's the guy who said to David M., a hit will buy you a house. To which David N. said to Jim Vellance, what will four hits buy you? A hotel?
But who came up with the title, Tears Are Not Enough?
That would have been, would I know them?
Yeah. They're part of a Canadian band, and then they went their own individual ways. It sound like the Guess Who, and makes it sound like that.
Yeah, it's not but them. It's not the Guess Who, not Bachman and Turner.
You're not going to guess it. It's okay. It's Paul Hyde and Bob Rock.
Oh, so Bob Rock suggested it, or Paul Hyde?
Oh, this is a very good question. They both take credit.
They both think they both think they thought of it.
But like, here's the
that's why they broke up.
Here's all the solo vocalists.
Okay,
and tell me you don't like everybody here. It's okay. Like Gordon Lightfoot.
Great guy.
You're like, there, all right. Burton Cummings.
That's cool. Burton Cummings, he's fantastic. Tall. They're basically the same person.
Then you get like Anne Murray comes in.
Great.
She's fantastic. We got Anne Murray. Yeah. Who's going to, I guess we're done now. Joni Mitchell just showed up.
Joni Mitchell.
Okay, there we go. I'm not sure who this is.
Okay.
Dan Hill.
Sometimes when we touch.
Okay.
The honesty's too much.
Then we go into Neil Young.
And I'm going to stop. Neil Young. Okay.
Yeah. Then we move on to Bryan Adams.
Bryan Adams.
By the way, hey, Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
Waiting to be number 7 on the list for a song you wrote. Good for you. Good for you taking your time. You could have been Johnny first.
Nope.
On there. First on the call sheet. Next one. Look, it's the time.
Okay.
Corey Hart.
Corey Hart. Sure. He wears sunglasses at night.
Bruce Coburn. Next.
Okay. Bruce, like you pronounce his name properly.
And Geddy Lee.
I wish next, had a
and
you're like,
launcher. Oh, Geddy Lee. And everyone's so happy to see Geddy Lee.
Yeah, Geddy Lee's
and
great.
Then we're, again, it's the time.
Okay.
It's the era.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Reno.
Loverboy.
There you go. But I mean, of course.
That's
I mean,
a big famous
7
band.
Number one hits. Loverboy. You're going to be, of course you're going to get Loverboy.
You can't have him there. That's ridiculous.
What's wrong with that? Of course you're going to.
Is there no member of Chilliwack in this mix? No Bill Henderson showed up?
I'm going to tell you who else was in
okay.
this. Now these are the folks that are only heard in duos and trios.
Okay.
So Liberty Silver.
Don't know
who that. Well, let's find out who Liberty Silver is then. Liberty Silver is a Canadian singer from Toronto, Ontario.
Of course she is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there she's good.
She was there.
She was there.
Yeah.
Then we get Carol Baker, Ronnie Hawkins, Carol and Murray McLaughlin.
Okay.
Singing together.
Ronnie Hawkins, yeah, sure, because everyone knows him. The guy who founded, basically was the original employer of the band before they became the band.
Then we get to, this is the French lyrics.
Here we go. René Simard.
Veronique Bellevue.
Okay.
Robert Charlebois.
Charlebois.
And Claude Dubois.
All right.
Don't know who they are, but that's absolutely fine.
I know the second one, Charlebois.
Donnie Gerard comes in after that.
Sure.
From the band Skylark.
If you say so, another Toronto.
Alfie Zappacosta.
Another Toronto person. Zappacosta was a thing.
Yeah. Was he Toronto?
Oh, of course.
Well, here's why I never thought he was Toronto.
Okay.
Was because he did, I forget what his big song was. But whatever his big song was, he shot it at the back alley theater basement. Like theater, and then in the basement.
Oh, okay. Maybe he's from Vancouver.
You know what?
Anyway, Zappacosta was a band.
Now
or a
I
thing.
Gotta look that up.
It was a thing.
Now I gotta look that up. I feel, yeah, hits. What are your hits? We Should Be Lovers. That was his song.
If you say so.
And
so it went over my head, everyone.
No, he was known as just his surname and no one's saying where he's from.
Okay.
So, sorry, I can't help you with that. And Lisa Del Bello.
Lisa Del Bello. Okay, sure.
All right.
Yeah.
Then we go Carol Pope.
From Rough Trade.
Damn sure. Right.
Still writing songs.
And Paul Hyde.
Yep.
Name suggester.
From Jekyll and Hyde.
From the Paolas. Then, yeah, we get Mark Holmes from Platinum Blonde and Lorraine Segato from the band?
Segato.
I think you can rise up to the challenge of coming up with
The Parachute Club.
That's correct. So what member, name the members of SCTV that sang
Doug.
In the background.
Bob and Doug.
No.
No?
No.
Really?
Neither was there.
Wow, I thought for sure they'd be there because Geddy Lee was there. What year was this?
Ooh, that's a good question.
So John Candy. I'm going to say John Candy.
85 is correct. Yes, John Candy was singing. There, absolutely.
And there was another?
Two others.
Martin Short?
Nope.
I guess he would have been SCTV at that time. Okay.
You know what? Dave Thomas wasn't there, but his brother was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ian Thomas was there.
Ian Thomas? Okay. Yeah. That's right.
So two other painted, SCTV painted ladies. People we're looking for.
Painted ladies and a bottle of wine.
There's three other members of SCTV.
What?
Yeah. Well, one that you will not normally remember as a member of SCTV, but she was
Oh, okay. So Jane Eastwood or Jane East?
No.
Oh, Robin Duke?
Yes.
And then...
two others.
I would normally think of her as a member of SCTV. Two others. Okay.
These two were...
Catherine O'Hara?
Yes.
Okay. And then Andrea Martin, I guess.
No.
Oh, no. Really? It's got to be the Canadian ones. I guess that's it. Because Andrea Martin's American. Joe Flaherty's American. Tony Rosato?
Who are you missing out on? Nope.
okay.
Sang an Academy Award nominated song.
Oh, Eugene Levy?
Yes.
Okay. He is Canadian as well.
There
took
you
me
are.
A minute. Took me a while, everyone. I'm embarrassed.
All right. I'm going to go through a couple more.
I know that our listeners out there, our international listeners, are fascinated by our deep description of a song that came out in 1985 that was a mere jumping on the coattails of We Are the World and Don't They Know It's Christmas, which was the first one, Don't They Know It Was Christmas. And apparently Bob Geldof was flown in to L.A. to kind of give a pep talk to the assembled multitudes of rock stars. I think it was Michael Jackson and his producer.
Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones, yeah, who kind of started this thing, got the ball rolling on it, and convinced people to come. And some people... got fed up and left before it even started. They just like, this went, no, this is not going anywhere.
Wasn't there a sign saying, leave your egos at the door? I think there was.
Maybe.
Yeah, and they didn't.
No one did. No, of course not, because that would be. there's a great clip of someone singing. I can't remember who it was. It might be the guy from Huey Lewis singing. And Michael Jackson is looking on in like disbelief and horror. Oh, he's singing. It's in the background. He's just, he kind of turns his head like, what is going on over there? But anyway, So apparently, yeah, Bob Geldof has flown in and he like talked about the plight of the Ethiopians and gave like a pep talk and kind of like, you know, we're in this together and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he did all the stuff and then he just left after that. He didn't hang around for the recording session or anything, which was a bit fraught, as I understand it. Because no one left their egos at the door and there was a lot of, you know, sort of hustling for where you're standing for the video and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Quick trivia question.
Sure.
What TV show did Bob Geldof and I both do at different times?
Switchback.
Thank you very much.
And apparently Bob Dylan had to be taught to sing like Bob Dylan.
Oh.
Because they want him to do the old Bob Dylan. Yeah, the times are changing. But he was the new Bob Dylan, so he was singing differently. Like, oh no, but I want to sing it like this. He's like, how, like what? And they're like, you know, like you used to sing. I don't know what you mean.
I always wonder that when people go on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and he impersonates them and they do duets.
Yes.
If they've got to then like sing like they used to sing.
Maybe.
You know, like a Neil Young has to like sing like Neil Young. I know like Bruce Springsteen has Doug singing as a... as his, well, you know the story of him going on the show, right?
No.
Okay, so he went on, and I forget his, first of all, I'll just tell you really quickly. Also, Leona Boyd was there. Also, Frank Mills was there. Also, player. Oscar Peterson.
Frank Mills,
also,
the music box player.
Also, music Paul box, Schaefer. Actually. Also, Jane Sibbery.
Jane Sibbery,
and,
nice.
And many, many more. Okay, so.
All the Canadians are. Anyone who was in Toronto that week, they were
now, there. I forget who the manager was, but it was like Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen.
Old manager.
Oh, Mike Apfel. Mike Apple, I think.
Sounds about right. Mike Apple. So they were doing...
not John Lando.
They were doing a jam thing where, like, I believe Jimmy Fallon was singing as Neil Young and he was going to be... Bruce Springsteen was going to be Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
And so he agreed to it. That sounds fun. Come on in. And then they asked, like, so do you mind, like, dressing up as old Bruce Springsteen? Like, the old version of yourself?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, man, I don't think that'd be a good idea. And it's like, okay, well,
you can... So, like, the Born to Run version of himself?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah, the old, the like, 70s. Basically, like, old.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, he was like, I don't know, man. And, yeah, Bruce doesn't
bandana,
really want to do this. Yeah.
Plaid shirt.
And it's like, okay, well, here's the thing. If you just try it on, and if you think it looks stupid, we'll just do it as you, and that'll be fine.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, man, I don't know. So they're getting ready to do the show, and he's going to try it on, and it's getting close. And he goes, and he gets the outfit on, and they give him the hair, and they give him the glasses, they give him everything. And then he wasn't looking at himself while he was getting everything on.
Yeah.
Then they spin him around, he looks in the mirror, and he just almost chokes up because he looks just like his old self. And then his manager comes in the room and his manager starts crying. Huh. And it's just like, oh, Jesus. It's like,
so this is his current John Lando would be the one.
Okay, yeah, and he just starts like, you know, because it's like you're the old you. You're just the old you.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, we'll do this. That's fine. That's it just nice. Made him so happy to dress up as like his old self. Yeah. And yeah, when he came on stage, because he was one of those surprise guest type situations, everyone just lost their damn mind. Well, so I'll find you the clip of that.
Why wouldn't they? And they, of course, they had to pull him off stage, of course, because he just wouldn't leave.
He played
for 3 hours, came out later on and played for another 3 hours.
Yeah, it was interesting. He kept playing until the host changed again.
Good for him.
Good for Bruce Springsteen being Bruce Springsteen.
He's a guy.
Yeah. And there were singers from the Spoons and the band and whatever. Anyway, and I have the Good Brothers, and there you are.
A lot of people there.
I don't know who Wayne St. John.
All Canada turned out for that. All pop, like all pop, you know, like popular music Canada.
Yeah, when there's someone that I don't know, it's definitely a jazz musician. So there you are. Ooh, okay. Yeah, now I'm learning about Canadian funk, jazz funk bands. Good for there.
Good for Canada.
If you're looking at what to do for your next podcast, Canadian bands.
Canadian jazz bands.
Why not?
Sure. I can't see anything going wrong with that. A whole episode on Mo Kaufman, the flute player.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got any more?
Any more jazz guys?
Canadian jazz funk guys?
Jazz funk. Oh, I don't know about jazz funk. Sorry. Yeah, no. I don't even know Mo Kaufman.
I feel bad because I know Oscar Peterson is a genius and was one of my dad's favorite musicians.
Okay.
And I know
and him. There's a Canadian heritage moment about him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I want to hear about it in a second.
I don't.
But I also want to tell you my Canadian heritage moment, which is him doing the theme song to Coffee Mate, where it's Oscar Peterson for Coffee Mate, and he's just playing Coffee Mate goes great. Coffee Mate smooths the flavor, so let Coffee Mate let your cup of coffee taste great. It's like And so when I think Oscar Peterson, that to me will always be his greatest hit.
Do you think? How Oscar Peterson got a house.
Sure.
Yeah.
So with his heritage moment, was it, you can't be a musician, Oscar. I don't want to be a musician. You can't be a musician.
It might have been. I don't remember now. It's been a while since I saw it. I apologize.
Okay. Well, now I'm
We'll have to put it into our, we'll have to put it onto our,
yeah.
We'll put it on the site, the website.
Yeah.
If you want to check out how Oscar Peterson became Oscar Peterson.
And I want to also then include, of course, the Superman one, because that one
real name cracks me Herman up. Blount, and he changed it too.
Is it?
No, that's Sun Ra, who came from Venus. His real name is Herman Blount.
They also, because whenever I think of the Canadian heritage moments, which I actually know some people on, that's weird. but the Superman one is the one that I like the most, because it's like one of the worst. Which is
he's on the train. He's like, I'll send you a picture of Superman when I come back or whatever, when I get there or whatever.
Right. It's because Joe Shuster was Canadian. And I know that because my wife's got a Joe Shuster award. How about you, Ian? I was nominated. It was an honor just to be nominated.
It was an honor. Sure.
Yeah. I went to the first ceremony. You know who was the big winner there? Dave Sim. It was so long ago that everyone was like, hey, Dave Sim. That's pretty good.
He probably was part of getting it together.
Who was I sitting behind for? Was Jerry Robinson.
Wow.
The creator of the Joker and Robin. Wow. And I had a nice conversation with him. But he was there to present sort of the awards like existing for the first time and talking about his friend Joe Shuster.
Cool.
But in this Canadian heritage moment, yeah, you're right. The real Lois Lane is there, who's like, get on that train, Joe. And he's like, hey, Lois, I came up with an idea. You're a real idiot, Joe. No, it's about a superhero. Shut up, you stupid piece of shit. And it's like, okay, what kind of relationship do you guys have? It's like, look, he's a super strong guy and he can fly. Oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Well, you should stick your head under this train. Let it run over and just end your life now.
She doesn't say that, does she?
She's pretty negative about everything. Till the end where, like, you know, he hands her like his original drawing of Superman. And it's like, hey, take it. It might be worth something someday. Shut up, stupid. Off you go.
You dreamer.
You stupid, stupid, stupid dreamer. I hate you. That's the way a lot of Canadian heritage moments go. I came up with basketball. You fucking idiot. Like, whoa.
That's not like that. It's, the guy comes back for, he wants his peach basket back. That's, yeah. That's not so bad. Yeah, the ones I remember are the one about the orphans who get adopted by Quebecois families but are allowed to keep their Scottish surnames. So,
okay.
So there's still a lot of MacDougals and whatnot, but they're like French-speaking MacDougals in Quebec and, you know, whatever else, McKeevers and on and on. And then...
and it was Heritage Minutes. Sorry about that.
Heritage Minute.
Listening moment.
I remember that one. I remember the one with Laura Secord running to warn the British about some upcoming attack. Probably the Americans. Those jerks. And then, oh, let's be fair, probably Fenians. And then, what's the other one I remember? The other one I remember is...
Oh, I smell toast.
No, that's not one I ever saw.
Oh, okay. The other one I remember. That's why everyone says I smell toast when they do their stroke joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Is because we had the one where the person was getting the brain thing and it was like, I smell toast.
Yeah.
Canadians, helping you to know what... this mapping the brain.
Yes. No, the one I remember is the Canada where they've come up upon the First Nations.
Yes, that's a pretty funny one.
Who tell them that they're going to go to the village. The Canada is the word for village. And then they go, oh, it's called Canada. All right.
Canada. It's village.
Yeah. Those are the three. The other ones don't really stick in my mind so much.
Oh, one that should stick in your mind is the invention of maple syrup.
Never saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot more. One. They've updated. They've done new ones.
Yeah, they have done
new ones. Which are a lot more inclusive. So they have a lot more, you know, like first black person to go to a movie theater and things like that. Or at least broke the movie theater color barrier and things. So,
oh my gosh, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. There seemed very few when we were going to. They used to play them in front of them before the movies.
Yep.
And now they. I don't know where they show. I guess they show them on television.
Oh, and Emily Murphy one was good.
What's that one?
She was the one that was like equal rights for women, and you know, the people were like all the mean men were there, just like, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be this, that, and the other, and then she someone like puts a book in front of that guy and just like, why don't you just show her where she's wrong in there, and it's like. Y'all know I cannot read a word. He's just a shamed man who's like putting down this smart woman. Yes, you know I can't read a word. And then they cut to the Heritage Minute logo, and you just hear a single gunshot. Blam! He died of shame. The Halifax explosion one is also like one I always
remember. I have seen that one more recently. I caught it somehow, but yes, that is a
there's a lot of these,
because that's a person who sacrificed his life to warn to stop a train that was coming into Halifax to make them stop before it came into the kill zone.
Yeah,
unfortunately he did not escape the kill zone because he was telegraphing to the train, so he was one of the many people who died in that insane explosion. Why you had two boats, one full of munitions, another full of gasoline out in a harbor together, as no one knows.
But. Yeah. Yeah. Just like a year before, they had that great chocolate peanut butter boat smash. That worked out way better.
It worked out a lot better. A man who was there, Mr. Reese's, he saw it and he said, or Mr. Reese, I guess.
No, they're all torn to pieces. Wait.
there's a silver lining to this cloud. Have you tasted this?
What the? So many bodies in there, Mr. Reese. Yeah, but if you pick out the bodies, listen, they're really good. I mean, it's making them all the different colors, Mr. Reese's. Like, all right. What do you think, Jonathan Smarties? I'm just gonna leave this one alone. Right, rapper Eminem? What am I doing here? I don't know. I'm just trying to think of a way to get Eminem's involved in this. Am I a time traveler?
That's right. You rap so quickly that you've gone back in time.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. It could happen.
That's right. What was his thing? 8 mile? 8 minute. You can go back. No, it doesn't make sense going back 8 minutes. There's nothing. There's nothing at all.
I think he did do something where he like rapped really quickly. But
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
But I
thought you were going to say he did something where he went back in time.
Oh, that's right. No, he really did time travel. Eminem.
All right.
That's how the Eminems are named. Like, oh, who's this young blonde fellow? He's the real Slim Shady.
Oh, that's how all the other Shadys showed up.
That's
was
right.
Through time travel accidents. He was all a little bit different.
But he was the real Slim Shady.
Okay, that's
all
good.
The other ones were fakes. Yeah. Oh, time. Time travel. And also rap jokes by people who don't know rap music very well.
Okay, I feel like we were making fun of all different types of music earlier because we, you know, covered a wide range of Canadian artists.
I don't know. We're making fun of them? I thought we were pretty supportive.
We were, but I was, you know, my Oscar Peterson thing is just like
coffee made. Oh, yes, you were being very mean to Oscar Peterson.
I was not.
I enjoyed...
I
don't think we'll recover from that.
I don't... Whenever I drink coffee, I don't put anything in it. But if I did it, I'd have no problem with putting in Coffee Mate. That guy sold me on it.
Tastes great.
Yeah, it makes your cup of coffee taste great.
Ding-ding, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-dee-dee-dee. We only play the black keys.
Okay.
Because that's the minor keys.
All right.
I did. Okay.
And minors can drink it because there's no alcohol in it.
That's right.
And now Dave Brubeck for Kool-Aid. I don't know.
I just think of as kind of like, you know, minor chords and stuff as being jazzy sounding.
These are things you know. And my dad would have known. But I just did. I never got into jazz.
Really,
I'm
I
so
really
sorry.
I do like jazz. I like it a lot of a certain variety.
How many jazz albums do you think you have at your place?
Not very many.
Mm.
Not very many.
How many jazz albums does your dad have?
My dad doesn't have that many albums. Like, I only think he only has like 4 or 5 jazz albums in his collection.
Oh, okay.
Like, he liked jazz, but he wasn't like a big buyer of albums. I think he would listen on the radio.
What was the most commonly played album when you were a kid? Because mine was probably Dave Brubeck, probably Take 5.
That my dad played?
That my dad played. He liked Dave Brubeck a lot.
My dad was weird.
Taste of Honey. We'd get that one a lot.
Herb Alpert? My dad preferred The Lonely Bull. My dad didn't listen to music when I was... He would listen to Christmas... He put Christmas music on at Christmas time.
All right.
But I don't ever remember my dad, like, listening to music. He did play us Dave Brubeck's Take 5 one time, like, my brothers and I. He played it for us, and he was like... giving us a lesson on what we should be listening to in the music. Like, he's like, listen to the drums. Listen to Joe Morello play the drums here. You know, he's doing this, da da da. Or listen to this, you know, listen to how Paul Desmond's playing.
He was the Sneaky Dragon listening party of his day.
of my life. But that's the only time I remember him doing that. Like, he didn't pull out his album of, I can't remember the jazz guy's name.
DJ Jazzy Jeff?
No, Art Blakey. He had Art Blakey and his Jazz Messengers. And you named a rapper.
Okay.
Which, so we want to get there.
Well,
we don't want to go back there
why
again.
Why has he got Jazzy in his name?
That's a good question. But yeah, so my dad, he never pulled like an Art Blakey record and played it for us, or Stan Getz or whatever. Like, he just had a few kind of popular albums. And yeah, he wasn't like a big music listener. Like, I was the phonograph hog. You know, we had like a big... You had like one too, right? Like a big cabinet player, which I loved it. You know, it was great. But I could play 78s, I could play 45s, and I could play 33 and 1/3 albums.
Yeah, of course.
It also had a record changer.
Amazing.
You know, like you could...
What's more technologically advanced? That still blows my mind.
Well, it wasn't record changer. I shouldn't say that. It was a stackable player. So you could stack your records on it, and they would drop down and then play a side.
Sounds
and then
great.
It would come back and the next one would drop. And so if you were like, if you wanted to scratch all of your records in one day, you could stack them on the record stacker and have them all drop. Because 60s records were different than 70s records. 60s records had a bump, had a, like where the label was raised. And so if you had a record player that did that, there would be like the two bumps would come together and they would keep the, where the, you know, where the actual like rill, where the line
shows
records.
What I know.
Yeah.
This is good new information.
There you go. But we also had a stacker for 45s as well. It was like this little thick, like a toilet paper roll that went over. It wasn't toilet paper roll, but it was like a plastic thing. And then you just stack your 45s on it.
I would go
A-sides
for that.
Up naturally.
I would go for that. I would love to have like a nice hi-fi in the basement.
It's pretty hi-fi. Yeah.
Oh man.
Ours was in the living room. And the problem with being in the living room was that everywhere in the house had to listen to me music.
Yeah.
So when I was playing my more outre songs, my dad wasn't so keen on it.
Why aren't those super cheap now? Get a nice hi-fi. That'd be great. I remember there was a neighbor who had one of those hi-fis, had TV in it.
Okay.
So you got the TV sound through the hi-fi, which back then, who gives a shit?
Yeah, yeah.
But it still was the most technologically advanced thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And it had the sliding... doors on so it would cover the TV up.
Okay.
Until it's like, hey, who wants to watch TV? Slide the TV open.
Yeah.
And here we go. And, well, we got to let it warm up first. Settle down. We can't just watch TV. We've got to settle down and watch. Wait. Here it comes. All right. There you go.
Good old tube, now let's tube technology.
Let's decide what we're going to, what channel we're going to put it on, because we're going to have to get up to change the channel.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of, once we've settled on a show, unless you want to get your ass out of the seat and then start flipping around.
But you have to admit, you're pretty good flipping it, flipping channels. Like,
it felt good to flip the
channel. I could flip from one station to like up and just stop on the on a dime. Like, I knew exactly how far to like.
Yeah. Here's what. Listen, hey, technologists that are out there listening. You know how you guys have those retro video game things that look like old controllers, and you know you can plug it into your TV and over there, and usually it's a wire, but sometimes it's not a wire. But you need one of those with like an old-timey TV knob, right?
Yeah.
So that like you can change the channel on your TV with this knob.
Mm.
Oh, feels good.
Yeah,
feels real good. And then like you gotta have the volume knob underneath. You can turn, and then underneath that, tint. I never understood what tint did. It was just,
it changed the tint.
What's tint?
Like the, it would, you know, it would give it, make it more pinkish or more yellowish or whatever.
Well, here's my question to you. If tint's a real thing, how come in the last 20 years, 25 years?
Yes.
30 years?
Yeah.
You have not used the word tint.
Well, you're not, you don't work in a paint store.
Oh, do they use that word a lot?
Yeah, of course they would.
All right.
Yeah, the, like,
well, you're an artist, tints. Right? Like you, okay, wait, you, so you do your Photoshop.
Yeah.
You'll do like a Sneaky Dragon title card.
Yeah.
Do you ever like, is there a button that says tint and you got to work the tint?
There's no tint button.
Working the tint.
Working the tint. Yeah.
That sounds like something you did in the 80s. Sometimes at the end of a night, yeah, they'll work the tint.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. A lot of guys didn't know how to work the tint.
No.
I feel bad talking about this, but like, it's such a good
word. For those guys.
Right. It's such a good word.
Tint.
Tint.
Yeah,
it is. And it was so important that it was second only to volume in the importance on your screen.
All right.
I think we had a tint button on our black and white set. Why?
I remember there was the vertical and horizontal.
Okay. But those were underneath the tint button.
Yeah.
Because tint comes first. Tint,
well, because color is more important than...
Right.
And then...
When did that stop being an issue? Was that like when antennas went away?
No, but we...
You don't have a vertical or horizontal thing on your set now.
Once we got a color television, we had cable.
Okay. But like, you still had a horizontal and vertical.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't really need them anymore.
Okay.
So you're not getting signals that are kind of wonky.
All right. Yeah, you actually had to work that knob and figure it out and line it up. Otherwise, you got like flipping pictures.
Yeah.
It's,
you had to work the knob and know your tint.
Well, if you didn't know your tint, you'd be at home later in that night working the knob. Electrolux presents Dirty Humor for Bachelors. Hey, fellas.
Let's talk about getting horizontal.
If you want to get her from horizontal, from vertical to horizontal, use an Electrolux. No, that's not right. Electrohome.
Yeah.
Fuck. Electrolux was a vacuum cleaner.
Yep.
Oh, that's a terrible mistake.
And don't forget to adjust your bunny ears.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. The name for an antenna.
I wonder when the last Playboy Club was.
I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know. Probably still is a Playboy Club.
I'm going to look that up.
I bet you there's one still in Chicago.
Do you think so?
I'm going to bet.
All right.
How accurate that bet is, I don't know. But this feels like, why wouldn't there be? They're still making money.
Okay, the Playboy Club.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just, because it feels to me like that's something that clearly... was gone.
So had its day?
Yeah, it was founded. What year do you think it was founded?
The Playboy Club?
Yeah.
1958?
That would be 1960.
Ah, oh, so close.
Yeah, okay, so here we go. The final one closed its doors in May 2014. Ah. Briefly reopened in Midtown Manhattan in 2018.
Yeah.
And closed in 2019 after people went, what the hell is this, a Playboy Club? Yeah. Okay, well, yeah. It's 2019, guys.
Mm.
Knock it off. I'm like, all right, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I can name one famous Playboy bunny.
Me too.
Who?
Gloria Steinem.
Oh, Debbie Harry.
Ah.
Yeah. What's wrong? Our reactions?
No, it's just because I had just read something about Debbie Harry today.
Oh, okay.
And it's a real fiddle with the tint, fiddle with the knob style bit of information.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to put it in a way that...
Is consumable by...
Well, I know we're an adult.
Yeah, we have an explicit rating.
We're an explicit rating podcast. Okay.
I don't know why you're getting so puritanical already.
Okay.
All of a sudden.
So Debbie Harry.
Debbie Harry.
Of the band Debbie and the
Wind
Harrys.
Wind in the Willows.
Harry and the Hendersons.
Yeah.
Was in a hot tub with Penn Jillette.
Really?
Yes. And they were having strange choices. They're friends.
Okay.
And so they're having a nice time in the hot tub. And I mean, just like friends.
Yeah.
And then Debbie Harry is near a jet and just goes, "Hey, you know, if someone built this a little differently, this would be very pleasurable for women." And Penn went, "How do you mean?" I was like, "Well, here's all you have to do." And gave him the laydown on how this would work.
Oh, yeah. You know, women famously like under the tap on the bathtub. And,
very good. Yeah. So Penn Jillette.
Yeah. So famously, but you know, like.
Right. Penn Jillette, famous magician.
Yes.
Then goes to the patent office, patents this.
Yeah.
Which is a jet that is part of a hot tub.
Yeah.
That is designed specifically for giving women pleasure.
I see.
What was that called? Penn Jillette.
Okay.
And created this thing. So please tell me what you think the name of this pleasure giving jet was.
Was it the Harry Hole?
Oh my Lord, no, it was not. Oh my gosh. Oh, I don't feel good about any of this. Anyway, it was the Jill Jet.
The Jill Jet.
Yeah, like Gillette.
Yeah, yeah.
But Jill Jet. Nah. Anyway, so this was...
My name is better.
He owns the patent on this and
there. Poor Debbie Harry. Got cut out.
I don't know if she got a cut.
No, she didn't. She got cut out by that guy.
All right.
What a jerk.
Yeah, there we go. Jill Jet. This was, a hot tub jet, specifically angled for things.
Yeah.
And there you go. It was originally going to be called the Clit Jet. But I think it was the patent office went, no.
can't be that obvious.
Yeah. So, So anyway, that's the thing. I guess I don't feel comfortable with that story. Anyway, that story, that's from 1999. Huh. Year 1999.
I guess that's like with the vibrator, the patent office wouldn't go along with the name the Vulva Tenderizer.
All right, I'm going to put $5 down on the table for the first person to change the subject. Here we go.
Oh, $5.
All right, go.
Well, I can change the subject if you want.
All right, well, here's the thing that I was looking up earlier today.
Oh, okay.
I was listening again. I mentioned Jesse Fox, who is the podcaster.
Yes,
but he also
FAULKES
FOX.
Oh,
you? I think you might have the his book, the comedy book.
I have your book of his book.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So his name's on the front of that.
I'm almost reading it.
You're almost reading it?
Yeah. I'm
me
on
neither.
Page, I'm on page. I'm on page
30. It's a Peter Cook joke. It's a Peter Cook joke.
No, it's not.
Yes, it's very close to a Peter Cook joke, isn't it?
Barry Fantoni.
No.
Is that the credit to Peter Cook?
Yeah. I was just listening to Eric Idle.
Yeah.
And his book.
Yeah.
Talking about, Peter Cook and gave him credit for that joke. The joke of like someone saying
at a party. Yeah.
He asked, what are you up to? I'm currently writing a book.
Yeah.
Me neither.
Okay. It's so funny. Cause in the, it's from Private Eye magazine.
Okay.
And he could have written it but it's credited to Barry Fantoni.
Okay. In the book, always look on the bright side of life.
Yeah.
A sort of biography.
Yeah.
Credits it to Peter Cook.
It's totally possible because Peter Cook owned Private Eye. Like he was the owner of Private Eye and he wasn't the editor of it, but he owned it and would regularly drop in and provide bits throughout his life. he owned it till he died. So they could do what they wanted. He famously, no one had the guts to name the Cray brothers. You know who the Cray brothers were? They were famous mm-hmm. East End gangsters.
Yep.
And no one ever had the guts to put a name to all the.
I don't feel comfortable with you mentioning them now.
To a name to all the mayhem that they were putting the East End through. But Peter Cook named them on the cover of Private Eye and then immediately went on vacation, leaving everyone else to deal with the fallout of this. But yeah, it's funny. So I mean, it could be a case of like the famous, you know, I say it's spinach and I say to hell with it, which was the joke was written by E.B. White, but was, you know, credited to the cartoonist who drew the image.
Oh, okay.
You know, so and same thing might have happened with that as well. Like, so Barry Fantoni drew the cartoon and wrote his name under it. You know, but Peter Cook provided the joke, which is one of my favorite jokes. I first read that in my days when I was a lunatic. I went, you know, and I wanted to read more, you know, I wanted to find more about Private Eye because I just heard about it, you know, in relation to like Monty Python and Peter Cook and stuff like that. And so I remember one time going out to UBC, this is before I went there, I just took the bus there as a high schooler and went to the library and I found this book about Private Eye. I found a magazine, like it was like Life magazine or something, American Life magazine,
mm-hmm.
but they had an insert of Private Eye in Life magazine. So it was a bunch of like jokes, sort of, I don't know if it was the best of or whatever, but just a bunch of, or Private Eye just put together their own like little, you know, kind of sample book, a magazine of what a Private Eye magazine, or the jokes would have been like in Private Eye. So it leaves out all the journalistic stuff that's at the front of the magazine and just gives you the second half, which is where they put all their satire and whatnot.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it had that joke in there, which I just loved. And then I had just read in a really like, I did not enjoy it at all. It was like one of the hardest reads of my life, reading Raise the Roof Beams Carpenters, the J.D. Salinger book.
Okay.
And there was this little thing in this Private Eye, Raise the Roof Beams Carpenters and drop it on the head of J.D. Salinger, or drop them on the head of J.D. Salinger. And I just thought, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever read because I just had suffered through this stupid book and then they had this great joke. So. But it was all like, you know, from the 1960s, issue of Life magazine. And yeah, it was just crazy. And so I just found it at UBC. I just found it in the stacks there. Because I was looking up, what do you have that has Private Eye in it in their in their card catalog? And that was mentioned. So I went and dug that out and looked at it. And yeah, it was great. So this, you know, those are things I did when I was a kid. I would go to like the library and go through like the microfiche to look up reviews of Monty Python films.
Oh, that's
from
cool.
Like Time magazine or whatever, you know, like what did Victor Canby think of the Holy Grail? Just a young lunatic.
Someone should replicate microfiche also online. I was looking up.
Yeah, you don't need that now.
The spinach joke. And yeah, you're right. E.B. White is credited with it. Drawn by Carl Rose, captioned by E.B. White.
Yeah.
The full joke is a little girl and she's there with her mother. And the mother says, it's broccoli, dear. And the daughter says, I say it's spinach and I say the hell with it.
Yeah.
There was later on, I remember there was an ad for spinach. It was the same illustrator and it was like, I say it's spinach and I say it's delicious. I was like, oh, you sell out. But there was a song version of it.
Oh.
Are you familiar with this?
No. Well, maybe.
From the 1932 musical called Face the Music. This is good because I was trying to get into historical comedy.
Can I just ask, is this Face the Music, is this the one that the New Yorker like cartoonists and like writers and stuff put on at? They did put on their own review, but maybe it's not. Maybe it was done for something different.
No, it's a, okay, it's a musical. It's the first collaboration between Moss Hart.
Oh.
And I'll just tell you who it is. Irving Berlin.
Sure.
It opened on Broadway in 1932. But the most popular song from it was called Let's Have Another Cup of Coffee.
Oh, okay.
It was a political satire, specifically spoofing political and police corruption in the Seabury Commission. It was also satirized show business, showing the far-fetched economies, such as seeing four films with a room and bath for 10 cents. I don't know. The musical did not ignore the Depression, but found humor in it. And so, yeah, so there was a song called I Say It's Spinach and the Hell With It. So here is one of the lyrics from it.
Okay.
Long as I'm yours, long as you're mine, long as there's love and a moon to shine, I say it's spinach and the hell with it, the hell with it, that's all.
Okay.
Right. right. What did the word spinach also mean in Britain in the 19th century? It was another word for something
money?
Else. What's that? Nope, money? Not for money.
Not for money. For like nonsense?
Yes.
Okay. Darn it, that was my first guess.
And it's I a bunch money. Of spinach.
First guess, best guess. You know?
Yeah. So we should use that word more. So I was saying that Jesse Fox did this thing for Vulture magazine.
Yeah.
Where he talked about 100 jokes that shaped modern comedy.
Oh.
So I thought I would go through randomly.
Is one of ours on there?
Yes.
Oh, great. Let's go to that one first.
Oh, it was just me feeling uncomfortable about the whole clitoris thing. And my joke about turning your own knob. I don't feel comfortable with nothing. Anyway, so it goes from 1906 to, you know, kind of modern day.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to poke down randomly.
Okay.
And we'll see what happens.
Sure.
All right. And there we go. Okay. So the one of the first things that comes up here is Lucy and the chocolate conveyor belt.
Oh, okay. The Lucille Ball.
Lucille Ball.
And the chocolate conveyor belt. Sure.
Yeah.
That's a famous joke.
It's a famous bit. It's a famous bit, and the ways that it changed comedy was Lucille Ball was the first woman to run her own production company.
Yep.
On television.
Yep.
It was the first one to show multi-ethnic couples on television.
Okay.
And showed you know, someone who was pregnant and just kept always like breaking boundaries in what television was. So yeah, yeah, I'd say the Lucille I Love Lucy in general. Yeah. It changed comedy.
I've told you my favorite bit from that show, but it could also fall into that. That is a famous bit.
Okay. Anyway, that one, let me see, what year was that? That was 52.
Wow.
The joke that changed things in 1953 was a Mort Saul joke about the Joe McCarthy jacket.
Okay.
Now, have you heard about the Joe McCarthy jacket?
I don't remember. I heard the joke before, but I don't remember.
Well, let me tell you about the Joe McCarthy jacket.
Sure, tell me.
It's like an Eisenhower jacket, only it's got an extra flap that fits over the mouth.
Sure. So that was like an example of an entertainer who was willing to call out Joe McCarthy, who had, up to that point, had pretty much run roughshod over all the craven cowards in Hollywood and all the other entertainment industry, throughout the entertainment industry. Everyone just fell over backwards trying to like kowtow to this bully. And Mort Saul stood up to him and kind of, it's one of those sort of things where someone says something and people go, yeah, wait a second, why are we listening to this guy? You know?
Yeah, that's nice. Then later on, unfortunately, he became very anti-woman. In a weird way.
Yeah.
And it was just like, come on.
Well, he lost his sense of humor.
Yeah.
He became fascinated by the Kennedy killing, like his assassination.
That's also true.
But that's a sign of like, to me, that's a sign of someone who's lost their way and is looking for excuses to not have to figure things out. You know what I mean? Like, so they're no longer funny. People aren't laughing at their jokes anymore. The 50s are over, you know, and so I can't be funny. What do I do? Oh, I have this thing. This is super important. Who killed Kennedy? You know, it couldn't have been the person who held the rifle and shot him. It has to be someone else. And we're going to figure this out. This is super important. I got to give up everything else in my life to deal with this.
And people will probably really respect me for this too.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everyone respects me as like and values my opinion. And so here we go. Now I'm going to take it to the next stage.
Yeah.
And here we are. It's the Jon Stewart thing. It's like if Jon Stewart went, you know, after The Daily Show, oh, you know what? I'm going to run for public office.
Sure.
And, you know, now I'm going to show you all what's what. And it was like,
No, you're a funny person. That's your forte.
I think the thing about disliking ladies was, you know, it is the thing.
Can I just interrupt you for 1 second?
Please.
Jon Stewart is an example of a comedian who changed.
Yes.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah, and radically changed The Daily Show if you ever saw the Craig Kilborn version. Which is weird because they had A. Whitney Brown on the original version. You think, like, oh, that guy would be great for this kind of, but it wasn't a fit for as things went on. And Colbert was on both versions and radically changed his style as well.
Sure.
Colbert, for sure, also changed styles.
Yeah.
But I think like Mort Saul with his issues with women, it is that thing about, you know, we're the shoulders the next generation stands on. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you're the guy going, hey, who's standing on my shoulders? A dame? Why, I oughta get out of here. Yeah. Get me a cup of coffee, toots. And it's like, oh, no one wants to see this.
Well, I mean, that's true to a degree. But I also think it's just, who are you? Who are you now? In the 1950s, you had the run of the woman pile. This is the wrong word, but you know, women were flocking to you because you were a celebrity. You were well known. You were what was it?
And you then were they it, changed, as a Simpson says. Then they changed what it was.
Yeah, and so now he's not it anymore. He's just I think we're both relating to his appearance in the Dick Cavett show.
We sure are.
And you know, and so here's this guy
because Dick let him talk. Whereas another talk show host might shut that down, and Dick's like, let the fire burn.
And he is, yeah, and so he's, you know, and he's wearing like cowboy boots with slacks and, you know, just some attempt to like be kind of hip.
Yeah.
But it's not really working. And yeah, and so women.
He went later on right back to the old look. Where it was like the sweater holding the newspaper.
Sure.
He looked exactly smart. Like, he looked like a Mort Saul impersonator.
Shouldn't have never changed that.
Well, you can change. Just like be, a, you know, but don't be a dick about
don't
it.
Don't be a dick about it. But yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he's bitter. So, you know, women aren't flocking to him anymore. Whose fault is that? Women's. Women's fault. Is that the right way to say it? Woman's fault? Female's fault. Isn't that how they say it now? Females?
Sure.
That's a sign that you're not so mentally all, mentally together. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Anyway, females. Go on with it.
I feel like at some point you're just going to go, I yield the rest of my time. Go to credits. Blam. That's too bad.
You know I can't read.
I did a read. I cannot read a word.
All right. What's another joke?
1956, the next year.
Okay.
Here's a joke from there.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a pickpocket?
Yep.
And a peeping Tom?
Okay. What is it?
Well, a pickpocket snatches watches.
There's a theme to today's show.
That's from Red Fox.
That's a good one.
And that was from one of his album Laugh of the Party, and that's when he started putting out party albums.
Okay, that was a big dirty album.
That you would listen to. You know, it was sure. Like, listen, everybody, I got an album.
Yeah.
Put it on.
And that was one of the surprising parts of that of Cliff Nostroff's book is learning that Robert Mitchum, the actor's sister, was a composer of dirty like party like joke party songs.
Oh, neat.
And I think he sang some of that stuff.
Who
too.
Was it that? That Catherine O'Hara was parodying with her Dirty Party album character.
Oh, Rusty Warren.
Yes.
Knockers Up, her album. Yeah, I remember that. When we used to work at the record store, Reminiscing Records, that Knockers Up and another something or other of Knockers or whatever. These are all.
Oh, I just got that joke.
What?
I just got the joke, Knockers Up.
Okay.
I've seen I thought it was just dirty because it was like, oh, yeah, that's fine. But I didn't get the other aspect to it. Okay, I just got it.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
That's fine.
I'm catching up. When a joke has gotten 40 years later, but 40 or 50
just
years
looking
later,
at the album,
more
I never,
than that. Jesus never Christ, 70.
7 years since that album, yeah. I never listened to it, but I always imagined that, yeah, it would be like that kind of, I'm Rusty Warren, I'll sing a few songs for you at the piano. I guess that's basically what it was just dirty.
Isn't that cute? Isn't that true?
Yeah.
I love
the
Catherine O'Hara version.
Yeah, yeah. She's great. She was talking about
go ahead
recently, Joey Heatherton and Lola Falana and all those people
and people not knowing that it was a parody.
Yeah,
her character on the on the show.
Yeah, and combining Lola Falana and Joey Heatherton into whatever her name was. What was the name of her character?
Wasn't it Lola Heatherton?
Isn't Joey Heatherton was an actual singer? Wasn't she?
These
or am I mixing the name?
Yeah, very, very good questions.
I can't remember.
I just know she had a fling with Guy Caballero.
Should fling with everyone.
I want to say it was Lola Heatherton, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was the two names combined. Yeah, yeah. So good. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. So I'm just going to go up a year at a time. 1957, What's Opera Doc?
Oh, so the animated cartoon?
Yeah,
the
Bug? The Chuck Jones, yeah, changing kind of comedy. Like, there was nothing like that. There was nothing doing the Wagner opera.
It's not my favorite animated cartoon by Chuck Jones. But it's beautiful. But people certainly go on and on about it.
Well, it's like nothing else.
It has a cute horse.
Right. I mean, if you look at, like, the Warner Brothers cartoons before then, mm-hmm. even musical ones.
Yeah.
That just changed directions completely. That was
Yeah.
And the Ride of the Valkyries to Kill the Wabbit. Fantastic. 1959, we had a movie about two jazz musicians.
Yes. I can see the heading for this one.
Yeah. Which is...
Wish it was more...
Nobody's Perfect is the heading for this.
You wish it was more culture-breaking than it was. But
I'm curious to see the new version that was co-written by Amber Ruffin.
Okay.
From the Amber Ruffin Show and the Seth Meyers Show.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like it's a, you know, for the time it was, it's weird how you know, whatever the word is for crossing sexual culture lines of the time. And it does it in a way that didn't seem to get any pushback, you know? Like you don't hear about people like going crazy about it. It passed the Hays censors. Like, you know, the Catholic League of Decency didn't protest that film. I don't think they did anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a, you know, it's a pretty gay joke, but great nonetheless.
And the next one is Nichols and May's Improvisations to Music.
Mm.
So the scene they've got here is, you know, May saying, "Too many people think of Adler as a man who made mice neurotic. But he was much, much more, Nichols. Much more. May, much more. Nichols, much more. Can you move over a little? I'm falling off the bed. May, I'm sorry. Nichols, a great deal more." And yeah, definitely Nichols and May, you know, changed the rhythm of comedy for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had very successful Broadway run. And then, you know, both of them went on to do fantastic stuff after that. Yeah. They were members of the Compass Players, and from there we got like Alan Alda, Ed Asner, Shelley Berman, Del Close, and then Del Close went out and did all the Del Closean stuff, and yeah.
Well, you know, for all the Del Closean thing, he, you know, in terms of who he influenced, it's amazing group of people.
I always kind of think that. Okay, so this is me being negative about Del Close.
You're always negative about Del Close.
I am kind of negative about Del Close. Yeah. I do like Del Close, and I got all of his comic books. There, how about that? Every comic book that guy ever wrote that I'm aware of.
All six of them.
I have, wrote more than that.
Is that right?
Wasteland had more issues than that.
Okay.
But my feeling on it is like, look at all these people that he influenced. That's absolutely true. And look at all the people that, like, you know, he, you know, kind of pushed away and said, you're no good, and freaked out at, and went like, and you're a woman, and you're not funny, and you're this, that, and it's just like, well, you know, you never know, like, how many people who he kind of got rid of, who could have been somebody, could have been a contender, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, he influenced the people he liked, and if you got him when he was in a good mood, he was a genius, and if you didn't, he was a cruel fella, and, yeah. It's just kind of a sad end.
Different kind of idea of how you teach in those days. You know, as someone who went through some schooling with a kind of tough, rough, tough guy who was very, very, very meager with the compliments. You know, I understand.
Was he rough? Okay, but was he rough and tough on the days that he wasn't like out of his mind on drugs?
No,
so you didn't know that was random.
Yeah, there was not the random element of it.
Yeah.
It was just a regular, you know, kind of he was just an old guy who grew up in.
Yeah, it's not the paper chase.
On a ranch, you know.
Yeah,
so he had a different idea.
It's more like if
it wasn't the paper chase.
Yeah,
yes, that's right.
Who was the guy? Who was the lead teacher in the paper chase?
John Houseman.
Yeah. If John Houseman was basically Charles Manson, you know.
Yeah, the unpredictable part of it was a different thing.
When he was teaching you guitar, he was pretty good, but you know, you had to get him on a good fucking day.
I mean, that's a good point. I mean, Del Close was good at what he did, but he could have been a lot better. Let's put it that way.
I'm bumping up. I just went randomly to the 70s.
Okay.
1973.
Oh, I love this album.
We have ourselves Comedy Minus One.
It's a great album.
Right. Albert Brooks. I can't 100% remember it. I have listened to it twice. What is your feelings on Comedy Minus One, the Albert Brooks album?
Oh, I mean, like, what does he say about it there? Like, why does he think it's so groundbreaking?
Well, he says early in his career, the L.A. Comic, actor, and director longed to cheerfully destabilize the staid realms of comedy with which he'd come into contact. And every one of the TV shows he was on, he tried to do something that was unexpected and different.
Yeah, yeah, he did amazing stuff.
And then when it comes to a comedy album, did the same thing and brought that same energy to it.
Yeah, I mean, it has... So Comedy Minus One, the idea of whatever... He was basing it on an existing series of albums, which was something was missing from the record, and you as the listener provided it. So say you had an album that needed someone to play guitar with it. Mm-hmm. So you'd buy an album, it would have a tab that would give you like your chords that you would play along with the songs and things like that. And so Albert Brooks' idea of this album is Comedy Minus One, and you are the partner to his comedy. But he so subverts it that it's undercuts you as the attempted participant in it, but also has some of his other classic ones like you can find this on YouTube, but his national anthem, the search for a new national anthem, and pretending to be different people coming in to try and, you know, like, you know, I'm so and so from such and such, and I got an album, you know, and it'd be like, you know, and he starts off, you know, and the green on next, you know, and just, you know, it's just a brilliant, brilliant piece. And it's a very good album. I just think that Albert Brooks, like, he is so like that, like so subversive, that it's almost like he himself is that. Like, you don't just say Comedy Minus One, you just say Albert Brooks changed comedy just by being Albert Brooks. As someone who could like take something and then subvert it, but not to subvert it in a mean way. Oh, it's a lot of it's affectionate, like his ventriloquist bit, where the dummy, you know, is it's an affectionate bit, right? Where he's like making the dummy drink water while he sings, just things like that, you know, and like, or you know, smoking a cigarette, and the, you know, and all the rest, you know, there's somebody, you know, or just dropping the ventriloquist dummy on the floor like this carelessly.
Oh, it landed so well. It landed in like a position you couldn't.
You couldn't help her. And a lot of these things, he had no plan for them. He just went on the show and just did them.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't have a script or anything. He just went out and did it, you know. His takedown of improv, I know you love it. You know, just all those things are great, you know, because they're not done. They're not mean. They're like good observations of what this is about, you know, and it's just a fun send up of all those things. And he carries it into the movies. The whole thing, his whole season of Saturday Night Live is the same thing. These, you know, the idea that he's like this narcissistic guy trying to record himself all the time. And it's just, they're great. You know, they're just like a great comment on whatever they're supposed to be. Real Life is a great, you know, prescient movie about reality television, you know. So I would just say Albert Brooks. What's next?
Went with the Wind.
Went with the Wind. So that's a Carol Burnett show.
Carol Burnett parody of Gone with the Wind.
Man, so yeah, that's a great call because, you know, we've talked about the Carol Burnett show many times on this show. Because I think we're both fans of it, but it was amazingly smarter than it needed to be, that show.
Sure,
you know what I mean. Like what its purpose it served, the time it played at night. It was basically a show for your mom and dad to watch in between craft foods commercials, and
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet are on. Oh, okay,
who are they?
That's something for mom and dad.
Yeah.
You're kind of a bickering couple, singing some songs.
And yet their parody of Little Caesar,
the
Edward G. Robinson film with Steve Lawrence in the title role, is a brilliant parody of that whole genre of gangster movies.
They maybe they enhanced.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I saw her version of Sunset Boulevard
before
Sunset Boulevard, it is like, got that right.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one, like, if you were told... Okay, so you're going to do a parody of Gone with the Wind. What scene? The whole movie. Okay, what? And so how many sets do we have? One set. Okay.
Yeah.
And what? And so, yeah, we want to have like the parody of like the going up the stairs scene. Mm. All right, so we've built in some stairs. Okay, sure. What else we got? And just all the highlights. Just do it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Sure, that sounds good. How long is this going to be? About 10 minutes long. Ooh, boy. All right. Here we go. And yeah, it's got the best line in the world, which is the gown is gorgeous. Saw it in the window, just couldn't resist it.
Yeah.
Like the audience gasps.
Yeah.
The audience is like, it's one of those, oh. Yeah. It's almost acknowledgement of like the greatest joke you've ever heard. And then you can laugh as well. There's not as much laughter as there needs to be.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
like the laughter comes when you see her in the dress that's mm-hmm. made of like, you know, drapes.
And yeah,
it's
yeah,
just ridiculous
yeah.
with the big pole.
the curtain back. Rod, yeah, the curtain rod.
It's like, that's enough.
Yeah, yeah.
This is fantastic.
Yeah.
She's coming down the stairs. We're all having a great time. Fantastic. Oh, by the way, we've got the greatest punchline in the world for this. Do you now? Okay.
Yes, it's a great moment. And yeah, it's, yeah.
How are you going to do the maid? Well, we're going to have Vicki Lawrence play her. How are you having her play her? Oh, no, no, we're not doing that. Voice only.
Yeah,
voice
yeah,
only.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have to see how that it works out okay.
Sure.
Pretty good. Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. No, it's a brilliant
Harvey
show.
Korman is a fantastic Red Butler.
Well, he's a fantastic actor. That's a thing. Like, you know, like the talent on that show is amazing. Like, it's just one of those kind of perfect confluence sort of things, you know, that doesn't happen every day.
Yeah. 77, the intro to Annie Hall.
Intro to Annie Hall. So like the narration by Woody Allen or what is that? So just give me a taste of this.
Allen's masterpiece, Annie Hall, is jam-packed with jokes and moments that irrevocably change comedy. But the film's famous fourth wall-breaking intro warrants mention as it sums up Allen's career in one joke. In it, the writer-director star literally builds on the work of his comedic predecessors, telling jokey jokes,
yeah.
and then making them more introspective, neurotic, existential, and cerebral.
Huh.
So,
yeah, I mean, I guess there is that thing, right? Like, I remember the egg joke being in there where...
Yeah, that was the only... Here's the... Okay. The opening joke. There's an old joke. Two women are at a Catskill mountain resort, and one of them says, boy, the food at this place is really terrible.
Mm.
The other one says, yeah, I know, in such small portions. Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery, suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly. But yeah, the joke about the eggs, I watched Annie Hall with my mom.
Yeah.
Not a laugh. That last joke killed her. She liked the movie because of that one damn joke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, it is. I mean, I guess it's this kind of summation of his previous kind of wacky comedy into a kind of a new romantic comedy style, you know, that then would be taken up by, you know, When Harry Met Sally, et cetera, they all kind of draw on that, especially the New York element of it too, right? Like, think of all those sort of New Yorker romantic comedies that draw so much from what Allen did.
Now I'm going to move on to the 90s. Just because, you know, hey, there we go. Janine Garofalo's notes. And this is talking about her HBO comedy half hour and her talking about why she has notes. And it's, I have a piece of paper. Don't mind me. I'm a professional, but I have a lot of NutraSweet in my system and I don't have a good short-term memory. I have, you know, a lot of things I want to discuss with you and I don't remember what they are. I have them on this piece of paper. So don't mind me if I glance over. It's not because I don't care. It's because I can't remember anything. And yeah, that style of comedy really kind of changed the 90s.
I guess so, because you didn't really see notes. You didn't really see notes before that. Then yeah, that's true.
Even though we discussed Richard Lewis,
yeah,
you know, on last week's show, and yeah, he was a real notes on the stage kind of fella.
Yeah, but not when he was on the Tonight Show. Not when he was on.
Though I remember a comedy Letterman. Special of his with a giant piano,
yeah.
and he had his notes like everywhere.
But that's a bit different than, you know, like when he goes on the Tonight Show. It's he's there as a comedian. He's normally
doing panel. Like for you know, most of the years we saw him, he was doing a lot of panel.
I just saw him in Letterman. I didn't really see him I just saw one of his bit. Like I saw him do a set on the Tonight Show when I was going through some of his stuff last week.
Here's the thing about that is that they have cue cards.
Mm.
There's no stand up set you ever see where it's not on the cue cards.
Okay,
so there's no need for notes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, really? So they have it all written out for them, their actual set?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. No. Well, first of all, every joke has been gone through, like, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So they know what's coming up. There's no free ball in there.
Okay.
And then, yeah, it's all on cue cards. And it's also...
It's weird, because it feels like he ends his... before he finishes... Like, it feels like it ends before he's supposed to end, you know? Like.
Yeah. No, there's never a stand-up set that doesn't have it all on the cue cards. Huh. Also, people get nervous. But it's also for timing. And also you can get this happening too, where like someone's going long.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the producer will go point to the joke he has to go to next. And they point to the joke and it's like, you're skipping these two. We're going to this one. We're bringing it to the end.
Besides, I don't know if she's bitter towards men, but Ginny Garofalo is kind of that generation's Mort Saul. You know, that she kind of really went away from comedy into politics because that was way more important than being funny.
Yeah, know? and then I do feel like her heart was broken when Bush got elected the second time. There was a documentary about Air America, and you see when she finds out the results.
Okay.
And it's brutal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. And it's like, oh, nope, we've lost her. When you realize, like,
interesting.
Yeah, it's also, I think, like, when you go, like, the impact I had wasn't enough.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you go from there?
Where do you go? Yeah, true. You know, like, other people of that kind of ilk, like, say, David Cross, they're just too nihilistic to care. You know, like, they're not going to, they're just going to be like, oh, that's what I thought was going to happen anyway. Of course, it's going to be shitty. That's life's shitty. You know, but obviously, she didn't have that. She had this optimistic idea that we can really change how people are going to.
Yeah, I've met her a couple of times. And yeah, she's always like really wanted to talk about politics with comedians. Mm. But the one time I was kind of like, oh, it was at a casino, and it was all these comedians. It was like Marc Maron was performing, and Paul F. Tompkins, and Darcy Michael. And then there was another comedian who came on. It was another local fella. And she just started heckling him.
Oh, really?
Because the way that the casino kind of worked, it was like a whole bunch of seats.
Yeah.
Did you ever go to the one that was at Plaza of Nations?
Yes, I did. I went and saw
Gilbert Gottfried?
No, a Canadian guy who really kind of wanders from topic to topic.
Oh, okay. All right. It wasn't Norm MacDonald.
No, it wasn't Norm MacDonald. It was.
Wasn't the guy who talks like this?
No.
Okay.
Used to do a radio show on CBC Radio, like a music show on CBC Radio as well.
Okay.
But I can't remember his name now. Sorry.
Fair enough. But okay, so you know the way the seating goes. Mm-hmm. But if you go to the very back of that space, there was like a couch that was like on the upper right side.
Yeah, the comedy couch.
Yeah, it was Mary. Anyway, she was sitting on there, and she was just heckling from there, you know? But it just
weird.
Felt like, yeah. And look,
why?
Look, the
comedian, like his stuff.
Yeah, he was kind of doing generic
he's
stuff.
A little too.
But like, okay, he's on a bill with these great comedians.
Yeah,
and you know, the guy's since become a conspiracy nut, and there's some issues. But I
precipitated I just thought, by Ginny Garofalo.
But yeah, it was just like, what are you doing? Like, I could sort of see this if it was someone you knew. Or, you know, if they were kind of a big shot or something.
Yeah.
But just like, this person is so lower than you on the ladder that, like, Janine Garofalo is heckling you. Unless, of course, the whole thing was like, you should have just started talking to Janine Garofalo. But it was just like, nah, this seems mean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's not that's
well,
not
I mean,
great.
From where she was to what he was, you know, there's a big power differential there, and that's pretty unfair.
Yeah, that was disappointing. Okay, we got a couple more, and then I'll go on to letters. 1998, David Duchovny's crush on Larry Sanders.
I do not know this.
On the show, David Duchovny played himself.
Okay.
And whenever he was on the show, he had a big crush on Larry Sanders and would continue.
On Curb Your Enthusiasm?
No, on the Larry Sanders show.
Oh, sorry, Larry Sanders. Oh, sorry, I was thinking of other different Larry. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. And would just would play a cross between himself and someone with a big crush on Larry, and just the Larry Sanders show.
That's so great! It's a brilliant show. Yeah,
and amazing. Yeah, and again, changed things. So many people did their behind the scenes shows after that. And
looking at you, Ken Finkelman.
Yeah, and some of them were a little stale. And then I think the curse wasn't broken until 30 Rock.
Okay.
And if you want to see the curse continue,
see
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. As
Do I
like,
have to?
No, you don't. That's fair enough. Same year, the story of Everest came out on Mr. Show. And that was the sketch with Jay Johnson, currently not doing great because he of January 6th shenanigans.
Mm.
But it was about a guy trying to tell his story of like climbing Everest. And he just continuously knocked down this bunch of thimbles that were on the wall. And then they'd set the thimbles back up.
Yeah.
And he'd tell the story again and hit them again. And I just loved, first of all, just Mr. Show was groundbreaking. Yeah, so we got to just say shout out to Mr. Show. But the great thing about that sketch that I read about was they actually had to set up all the thimbles again. So the audience just had to sit and watch all these thimbles go back up. And they know this is going to happen again. It's oh, my God, how long is this sketch?
You would hate that.
Oh,
you
my
would have hated to
I
be
would,
there.
I would hate it, and I also would kind of admire it. I would admire hate it. And anything else before we go to letters? Sorry. They're just talking about Sex in the City. That's not wrong. The hair gel scene from There's Something About Mary. Something about Mary was, you know, good-natured sexual.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it. I liked it at the time. Yeah. That was a bit of a squirmer, but yeah.
Gilbert Gottfried doing his joke about right after 9/11.
Okay.
Which is, I have a flight to California. I can't get a direct flight. They said they have to stop at the Empire State Building first. Boo!
Too soon.
Too soon. Which is, first of all, that phrase became common.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it was kind of defined, you know, how far you can go with that kind of stuff. And then the Aristocrats movie came out of that, because Gilbert went into the Aristocrats after that and, like, got the crowd back.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah. And then this is a
The Aristocrats,
one.
I was going to say about The Aristocrats, is a movie where I took a sip of my drink and someone on the screen told this joke that was so funny, I had to laugh with liquid in my mouth for so long, and I couldn't swallow it because I was laughing so hard I would have choked to death and died. And so I was like just killing myself laughing while I had Coke in my mouth, and finally I settled down enough that I could swallow it. But
here was the only thing that made me not 100% on board with the Aristocrats movie was I went, this feels like it's a practical joke. This feels like comedians never did this.
Yeah, yeah. No, that felt like that the whole time.
It felt like this the whole
time. There were some funny parts to it.
And since then, I've learned it's true. It's true. It's all true. It's just like this kind of.
Oh, really? It's a true joke?
Yeah, it's a true joke.
Oh,
that, funny. You know, people tell, you know, after a couple of drinks or whatever, you tell this joke. I mean, it's not huge, but everyone sort of knows it.
Yeah.
They played it up like it was this amazing thing, and it's not this amazing thing, but everyone kind of knows it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kept thinking you're just making this up. You're making this up. And I was like, that's fine. there we are. Who really got upset about that film? Who, to the point, threatened a lawsuit about that movie?
Well, I imagine whoever Sarah Silverman accused.
Joe Franklin. Joe That's Franklin. Correct. Yeah, Joe Franklin raped me. Yeah. I'll go with one more here. And that is from the year 2003. Oh, there's two sketches.
Okay.
One was the black-white supremacist, which was the Dave Chappelle sketch, where it's a guy who's a KKK member who doesn't know he's black.
Yes.
Pretty great. And the Chappelle Show, The structure was almost exactly borrowed from the Chris Rock Show, almost exactly.
Yeah.
But definitely the sketches just hit hard and had such an amazing...
The Prince one was one of my favorites, the Prince basketball playing one.
Right, the Charlie Murphy story. Yeah, true story of just so much so that Prince put Dave Chappelle on one of his album covers. That's him.
Yeah, yeah.
And without his permission.
Yeah, yeah.
And Chappelle was like, "What am I gonna do? What am I gonna do?" That's great revenge.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. And the other one that they've got there is Bush versus Bush, which was where the Daily Show kind of came into its own.
Yeah,
where they played clips of George Bush and then had a debate between George Bush and a past version of George Bush where he was saying things that were antithetical to what he currently said.
Okay.
And it was like, we've got someone who disagrees with him and we're going to put him on here now. And yeah, they just played it and it was just perfect satire. Just letting someone take themselves down. So much so that I think that's what political satire became for forever. And then when Trump came along, that doesn't work on him,
because
you've got to have a sense of shame and you've got to have actually at some point some ethics that then you show that you went against those ethics.
You
have to have some beliefs and then go against those beliefs.
Sure.
And because he has no beliefs,
yeah,
you can't.
He's just an amorphous blob.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glue, you're glue. Whatever you say, we're all glue. Glue, glue, we're glue. Glue, ka-chub, glue. Yeah. Anyway, so that's, yeah, if you want to check that out, we'll probably put a clip of the of this up, which is the 100 jokes.
At least we'll put a link.
We'll put a link. No, I think we should type it all out. My God, when I was a kid.
Control C, sir.
My dad would buy these computer magazines.
Okay.
Okay. And they'd have like your own Pac-Man game. Oh, fantastic. And but then you'd have to type out all the machine language into the computer, everything.
Yeah.
Just random code that had made no sense to it. And it would be pages of it. And I'd do it. And if you've got any of it wrong, your Pac-Man looks like, you know, something Penn Jillette would put in his hot tub. Da-da-ding, a Jill Jet. Is it okay to go to letters?
Sure.
All right. I don't know. Maybe you had something else to say. I don't want to, you know, push you around.
That's fine.
I feel like I've been yapping a lot. So last week on the show, we asked questions. Oh, boy, did we ever ask questions. We asked, have you ever learned something from a record? Hey, there we go. Mm-hmm. Like your minus one records. And what was the first record you ever bought? Other media are accepted, too. Good for you. Being accepting of other media.
I am accepting of everything.
So our friend Edward Dragansky writes, as he does, good evening, good evening. Oh, fuck, I got the second word wrong. That does not bode well. I got four letters to read, folks. It
doesn't bode well at all.
Listen, you can fast forward if you need to.
Yeah.
I can't.
I will.
I'm living in the present. You can't. You're in the present with me.
Oh, shit.
Yes, you're stuck in time with me.
Well, I guess I'm going to have a rough evening.
You're in this flat circle with me. Good evening to all the sneakers around the world. I did have an instructional album at a very young age, maybe fourth grade or so, and I shared it with my friend Todd on the next block. It was the Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy album on How to Be a Ventriloquist.
Hmm. Probably that's where Edgar Bergen looked best as a ventriloquist.
Todd had a Charlie McCarthy.
He moved his lips a little bit.
And I and his wife appreciated it. And I had no Penn Jillette jet for her.
He knew he knew the secrets of the tint.
You know, Edward, I'm really sorry. You're doing us a nice story here, and then Dave. Todd had a Charlie McCarthy, and I had a Lester ventriloquist puppet. So we practiced and did our best to show off for friends and family. It was okay. But thinking back on it, we could have used a writer. Todd's a professional broadcaster and anchorman in Austin, Texas now. So I'd like to think I saw the early beginnings of his career along with the two dummies. So would you try and impersonate the voice of Charlie and whatnot? I don't know what Lester's voice was like.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay. The only Lester I know is Willie Tyler and Lester. And I did.
Isn't that who he's talking about?
Is he talking about Lester?
Yeah, that Lester, yeah. There's only one Lester.
Okay, well, fair enough. There was a Lester doll? Okay. This I gotta look up. Anyway, I saw the real Willie Tyler and Lester once at a taping of a show called The Don Heron Show.
Oh.
And they end the bit with harmonizing together.
Oh, that's tricky, eh?
Pretty tricky until I realized he brought the music.
That's still tricky. Just different kind of trickiness.
Okay.
Right?
Maybe.
He still tricked you.
There's a bit of me that, like, when I heard that, mm-hmm. I thought to myself, well, why can't you just do the whole thing like that?
Mm.
Like, if you just had, like, a recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're, I mean, you.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. You're, and all of a sudden, you just have to move the old thing. And then it made me think, like, oh, there's ways of faking this. Anyway. Strangely enough, Todd is also part of the story involving my first album purchase. I paid Todd a total of $5, my entire week's allowance, for the original double album Star Wars score by John Williams. He didn't want it, and I'd had a hard time finding it, so maybe it was the best $5 I've ever spent. What the album started for me is currently an ongoing passion.
I think I had that album, too. Was there some narration involved in it? Was the picture on the cover of C-3PO was prominently displayed? Anyway.
All right.
Because I had a...
Please let us know.
I had a record of the movie
nice.
As well, but it wasn't like a complete, like, the whole movie. It was just like excerpts and then music.
Do you still have the album?
I'll have to look and see. I might.
Because Edward goes on to say, I still have the album to this day.
there's no reason I would have got rid of it, unless my brother threw it away.
My first single was either Living Thing by what band?
Oh, sorry, what's the answer?
My first single was either Living Thing by
Yellow.
That's right, Electric Light Orchestra. Or Tonight's the Night, Gonna Be All Right by Rod Stewart. Yeah. I remember being upset over the Rod Stewart record. I thought it was another song when I bought it out of a cardboard box at the grocery store. Remember how those 45s were?
Was it This Flight Tonight? Is that the one you got mixed up?
In the paper sleeves?
In a rock and roll band.
I'm just...
Late in the morning we land.
I really like Electric Light Orchestra. I just don't like their cover band people. Anyway.
Still, after 2014, that was still under his skin.
With their hit song, Turn to Bone. A turn to bone. Leave me alone. I need a bone. Rough, ooh, rough, rough. It's an all dog band.
Ooh, evil drummer.
I even remember my first CDs. I bought two of them, both film scores, Raiders of the Lost Ark by John Williams and Beetlejuice by Danny Elfman.
Oh.
Remember how those were packaged in the beginning? They wasted all that cardboard by packaging them in these long, thin boxes with album art redesigned to fit vertically.
Oh my gosh.
I wish I knew the story behind that packaging snafu.
Well, because it was because the record stores were still album oriented. Like they still had all their shelves and stuff. The racking was all like 12-inch sleeves.
Well,
so
let me tell you what he thinks first, and then we'll counter that.
Okay.
Maybe it had something to do with utilizing the album's bin space for those long boxes.
There you go.
Instead of redesigning everything for CDs, which they did anyway down the line. If you have any insight on the evolution of that era in music packaging, I'd love to know it. I just wanted to say that out loud because the amount of Louise's jokes that I have screwed up
I'm sorry.
By jumping right on them, and then she delivers the killer punchline. It's like she's walking down the stairs as Carol Burnett and just like, she just opened the window. Did you get out of the habit? What did I ruin? Everything?
I used to have a bunch of those boxes, which I saved for years and years. And I think like 1 or 2 years ago, I finally caved in and threw them away. Because I just was like, why am I saving old long boxes for CDs? Like the only one I have left, Prince put out Around the World in a Day. He put it out as a long box, like the whole CD cover is like a long box. So the seat, you know, so it, and it folds out in this weird kind of neat way. So I still have that, but all the rest of them I got rid of. Which my plan at the time was like, oh, I'll cut them out and I'll just like put them on the wall or whatever, but I never did. And I had these two boxes for years and years of all these little long boxes. And I finally broke down and threw them away. Do I regret it? Yes, I do.
All right.
But I did it.
And rest in peace, Richard Lewis. I remember him fondly from everything mentioned. He brought laughter to the world, which is a reward for him. And all who received it. And yeah, I'm worried about those damn Ghostbusters too. Hope you're wrong, Ian. Swirled peas on earth, all my sneakers.
Swirled peas. When I went to see Dune Part 2 on Sunday.
Dune.
Which, by the way, this is not a spoiler, but this is a warning. The movie does not end in a way that makes you go, oh, this is the completion. It's all complete. It just kind of ends as like...
Done and doomed.
We're going to go do this. And you're like, oh, they're going to go do this. And then the movie ends. And you're like, oh, what? So I went by myself. At least I didn't want to see it. So I just went by myself, went and saw the IMAX. And I was sitting between these two people. And I just said to them, they got us again. But it was a good movie. But anyway, they played a new Ghostbusters trailer, one I hadn't seen before.
Okay.
They also played the trailer for Furiosa.
Okay.
A Mad Max story. Which,
how was the Furiosa one?
Looked pretty good.
Nice.
Looked pretty good. Anya Taylor-Joy looked pretty cool. Pretty cool. I mean, it's just a lot of like quick glimpses and stuff. I don't think they've edited or even finished the movie yet, but they put together some stuff in a cool way, and you went, oh, that looks cool, man. Looks cool.
I don't like that in the Ghostbusters trailer I've seen for Ghostbusters, Paul Rudd says, oh, that's cool. I need to hear that. I don't need to have a character in the trailer.
Yeah.
Tell me this movie's cool.
Mm.
That's all right. You know what you wouldn't never have seen that in? You would never have seen that in is the first Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah.
Any of the characters going, whoa, that's cool. No. Just catch the ghosts.
The one I saw had more Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd.
Believe it.
And had Annie Potts in as well, yeah, answering the phone. And
yeah. This really feels like, oof, last 10 minutes.
It could be. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've not seen the last one.
I feel like I'm scammed. Also, it feels like because Bill Murray shows up and everyone's like, hey, it feels like there's got to be an early scene where it's like, you got to help us. Fuck you. No, I'm not into this call for adventure.
Yeah.
Is that what Joseph Campbell says I have to? I'm not doing the call to adventure. No, I don't want to. Me and what's your name? Dana. Dana. Remember? Dana. Sigourney Weaver. She's good. She's a good actor. She should be in this. No? Okay. Anyway. Why isn't she a Ghostbuster? She beat an alien once. She's tougher than all of us. Louise writes,
yeah.
I don't really remember buying records as a kid. My brothers and I would get them as presents. Disney movie soundtracks, Partridge Family albums, KTEL compilations. We asked for greatest hits albums like the Beatles' Red and Blue albums and ones by John Denver and Elton John. I do remember the first 45 I chose just for me. It was Dark Lady by...
Dark Lady.
It's from 1974. It's a lurid story song of betrayal and murderous revenge sung by a...
Sure.
Yes, that's correct. It's like a mini film noir with a couple of shocking twists. So maybe it appealed to the to my Nancy Drew reading tween self. The B-side was Two People Clinging to a Thread. I remember telling the title to my piano teacher, a rather deadpan Scottish-Canadian lady. She smiled and made a rare joke about them not being able to hold on to it for very long. Very nice. Do you remember, it was either thank on the Louise. Sonny and Cher show or just the Cher show.
Sonny and Cher?
Sonny and Cher show. Pork Chops and Applesauce. Where they would have animated music videos of songs sung by Cher. And one of them was Leroy Brown. Let me write that down.
Bad Leroy Brown. Baddest man in the whole
downtown. So that maybe we can put up a clip of that. But I remember them doing other... Oh, yeah. And also there was something about like witchy woman or evil woman or one of those. Ooh, black magic woman. One of those. But they would do animated videos, music videos. And it was like, oh, okay. It's pretty good.
Huh.
Kind of the style... Kind of the backgrounds look like they were from Fat Albert. That kind of style. Popular at the time. Kind of Ralph Bakshi, but not... what the hell? Peter Ayers writes...
Oh, Peter Ayers.
Sup, fellas?
Sup.
And Ian, thank you for sharing the fact that Chubby Checker named himself after Fats Domino, a tidbit so blindingly obvious that it never occurred to me after all these years. This prompts me to ask you and fellow sneakers for any recent Today I Learned revelations you might have. Let's make that one of our questions.
I can tell you one right now.
Hit me.
Well, so it's just a week or so ago that I learned where Stan, the popular term to stan something, came from.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was related to the Eminem song, Stan, about a Uber fan who, of course, kills someone and is writing to Eminem and blah, blah, blah. I didn't realize it was based on that song. So I knew what it meant, but I didn't know where it came from.
And I think last week on the show, I said the tomato, tomato thing and potato, potato, that I was like, oh, that's a joke in itself. So any recent that's one of our questions then, is a Today I Learned thing. Revelations that you might have had. For example, I only just found out that the frown connotes significantly different expressions and emotions in different regions. Over here it means a furrowed brow and look of concern, concentration, or puzzlement, whilst I understand that in your neck of the woods it means a droopy mouth, hence turn that frown upside down. Or it takes more muscles to frown than to smile. And other sayings that make you want to punch someone in the frown. And Chubby Checker was much more than a one-hit wonder. I am plugging in my iPad that's about to die. There we go. Done. Was more than a one-hit wonder. If you haven't heard his blistering psychedelic freakout, Gypsy, then seek it out right now and have it clear your sinuses.
I don't know if was that a big hit though, or was it just something like?
I really enjoyed your chat about musical connections. I had no idea that Wilson Phillips' "Land of a Thousand Dances" was a cover of a cover, and enjoyed.
Phillips.
It said Wilson Phillips here.
Oh, did they do "Land of a Thousand Dances"? Or I think I was talking about Wilson Pickett when I was.
Oh, I think that's probably what they mean. And
okay,
I'm betting
maybe it just autocorrected.
Could be.
You know, Apple is a huge fan of Wilson Phillips.
You know, we don't pre-read these. And enjoyed listening to the Roots earlier in the week. To weave the threads even more tightly, last week, this led you to discuss various dance crazes, including the Popeye, and a quick search brought up Popeye the Hitchhiker by Chubby Checker.
Oh,
why not give it a listen? I thought, and hey presto, it's the hook from Jump Around by House of Pain. Jump around, jump around.
Really? I'll have to give it a listen.
Jump up.
Yeah. Because the beginning of the song is kind of a drag by the Buckinghams, the horn intro.
Ah, neat.
That's kind of a drag, which is weird because kind of a drag is sort of the same. That has that horn intro, then the song starts. It's kind of a drag. It has nothing to do with that horn intro. It doesn't really come in again. So kind of like Jump Around.
And if you want to keep on making connections, I'm sure one of you can get from House of Pain to Devo. Everything is connected. Dave, maybe it's time to bring some music back to the pod. I'm sure you could do a musical connection series. Just a thought. And I don't think I had any instructional records as a kid. Although I do know It's Madison Time, the It's Madison Time novelty dance featured in John Waters' much-loved Hairspray, and have taught it at a bunch of events. Even though the caller explains exactly what to do throughout the record, the dance is surprisingly confusing. Whilst the music is in eights, the dance is in sixes, so that it drifts off the melody. Plus, the caller's timing is off, so it's easy to slip out of sync.
Wow. I wonder if John Waters did that intentionally.
I wonder how the bridge is, and if it's troubled, and if it's troubled waters. I don't know what I'm talking about. The first album my parents bought me may have been Banging on a Drum, a compilation of songs from the BBC Kids show Play School and Play Away. The title track was, here we go again, sampled by Cold Cut for their smash hit remakes of Eric B. and Rakim's Paid in Full.
Oh,
only last
that's
month,
a good song.
I had the pleasure of doing some branding design work for Matt Black from Cold Cut, and have so far managed to resist the temptation to subject him to the stream of consciousness fanboy gush to which I've just subjected all of you. Thank you for bearing with all of my whiffle. It's a really good night to everyone, Peter. Oh, I don't think it was whiffle, though I might call it spinach. And I say to hell with it. Edward Dragansky replies, if I were a singer in the 50s, I'd name myself a beast chess piece. That is all. Very nice. So very one good. Of our questions for next time is...
Wait a second. I got an email recently. To read here.
Okay. Wait I would a love second. To hear
because
the email.
Because you... last week on during the show...
Yes, sir.
You were reading the comments from our listeners, which are very pleasant. And I was thinking, oh, I think I have an email. And so I went to my email and I was looking and I went, no, I read that last time.
Okay.
But I didn't.
Well, I guess then you don't have to... Oh, wait, what?
I did not read it before. So let me read... An email from Laurel Robertson.
Yay,
she says in her subject, you've got questions, I've got answers. Laurel writes, hello, Ian and David. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Every time the Sneaky Dragon theme music comes on, I just smile.
Aww.
Always. It's a happy feeling. Here come my chuckleheads. Thank you. Okay. That said, Ian.
Yeah,
You asked about favorite autobiographies.
Yeah, what's your favorite autobiography?
I've got many.
All right.
Memoir is my favorite genre. Lately, I enjoyed Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan.
Oh.
What an amazing tale. His life and adventures centered around surfing, starting in the 1960s as a boy in Hawaii. It's brilliant the way he describes surfing, the big waves all around the world. It made me long to trade in my boogie board that I always take to North Carolina's Topsail Beach each summer for a longboard. This book is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and Mr. Finnegan has written often for The New Yorker, so he has a connection with Ian and Pia.
Yay!
Other autobiographical works that immediately come to mind are anything written by Dr. Maya Angelou, beginning with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I especially love to listen to her books on audio. Miss Angelou reads in that smooth alto voice. David, you asked which movies we are looking forward to. The next film Dear Husband and I will be sure to see on the big screen is Dune, Part 2. He knows the novel well. We saw the first one and liked it. I don't catch all the plot, but I go along for the ride, the popcorn, and the chance to watch Timothée Chalamet again, who looks so much like our 17-year-old grandson, it's freaky.
I like that you could make his name rhyme. Timothée Chalamet.
Well, he has a double E at the end, so I assume it's an accent grave over the first E.
Yeah, screw the accent aigu.
Husband is especially looking forward to the giant worms. Yes, there are many giant worms. You get to see them in that movie. It's very good. I'm going to tell you right now. It is 2 hours and 45 minutes.
It's at least two worms up.
But you don't. Yes, two worms up. Two worms up. My worm got up during that movie. Oh,
thanks, Penn Jillette.
It was fantastic. It was just a really great. I went and saw the IMAX, and I booked a bit late because I wanted to make sure that Lisa didn't want to go because I was assuming that she wouldn't want to see it because it's a space movie and she's not into space movies. Okay. And so I asked her on Friday and she said no, just go on your own. So and she said, I'm busy on Sunday this time, and so I was like, cool, I'll book that day. So I booked online, which I'd love nowadays that you can like get a seat. You know what I mean? Like in the old days.
And not have to line up.
I had to show up 40 minutes early to try and get it. So I just love that you can just show up and get your seat. But anyway, so my seat was, so where our IMAX, in our IMAX, there's two tiers of seats. There's a walkway between them. So there's the back tier, which is kind of like ideal, like to sit at the front of that. And then, but I couldn't get those seats. They're all booked already. So I had to sit in the first area. And I thought I might be a little close and it might be a little bad, but it was actually really nice. It was really good. So, cause I like when the screen is really big. So I don't mind like looking around at what's happening over there. So it was really good. Anyway, I really liked it. But anyway, sorry to interrupt your story. Laurel finishes by saying, have a great good week all and belated happy birthday to you, David. Love and blessings, Laurel. Thank you, Laurel. And I did write and apologize to Laurel that I forgot to read her email last week.
Oh, that's nice.
And she wrote back and she said, let that be the least of your worries. You are way too kind. So, but anyway, I just would feel bad the idea that someone's like, oh, my letter's going to be read and then it doesn't get read. So I just wrote to her when I realized that I forgot before the show came out. So
here's one thing that would be nice if they had at movie theaters. Where
candied popcorn.
Candied popcorn would be okay. But something else would be where you could, where you're ordering your movie tickets, right? And then they ask you for your seat, and there's my seat. And then, do you want any snacks? Yeah. And you can just order what the snacks you want are. Yeah. And then they have the snacks waiting for you there, too.
Yeah,
so when you get there, and it's like, okay, boom, snacks.
Yeah.
Because as it is now, the only thing that's, is chaos is you line up for your snacks, and they're like, what kind of drink would you like? I'd like a blah, 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 drink. Oh, no, do you just do it yourself? Here's a cup. I'm like, okay. All right. I got to do the cup business myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got to walk over to the confused people who are swarmed around like wasps who are just buzzing around the soda area and they don't understand what's what and it's sticky and it's like, oh, this is unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Why am
I doing the work?
Yeah. How about I just enter in what drink I want. And then when you get there, it's like, oh yeah, this scan. Boop. Okay. There's your popcorn. There's your drink.
Well, as a Cine Club member, I can pre-order my popcorn and stuff.
You can?
When I get my tickets. Yeah. Yeah. I've never done it because I didn't get offered until this time. And I'm on my sugar fast, so there's no point getting popcorn because I can't have pop with it.
Oh, okay. We can have water with it.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting to me is if I'm, am I getting this right about the thing of Lent? The origins of Lent.
The origins
were,
of Lent.
The Lord was in the desert for
40 days.
40 days.
Yeah.
So
for 40 days.
So what you are, you're giving up sugar.
Desert. Yeah.
Okay. As far as I know, Jesus didn't care about sugar at all. But
it didn't exist in those days.
There you are. So, but the one thing you'd really want in the desert.
Yeah.
Nice icy glass of water.
Mm.
And that's the one thing you're letting yourself have is like, hey, I'm having the one thing. And it feels like, well, the one thing you should give up is delicious icy water if you want to experience that real desert sacrifice.
But the idea of it is to give, just to take it, have it a bit of discomfort. And to be frank with you, if I didn't have a glass of water, I wouldn't be really be sweating it.
Well,
just have milk or orange juice.
It does help
or
if you're in the desert.
Pop or whatever. Yeah. Yes, it does help if you're in the desert. It's true. I am not in the desert.
Yeah. That'd be interesting to just set up in some deserts, like a real nice cold drink stand.
Yeah.
And you just set it up in there just so when, and the odds are that someone, there's not going to be a lot of people dropping by. But the one person who is going through the desert going oh, I'm so screwed. I'm so lost in the desert. And they see a nice icy drink stand. Oh, boy. Be so happy. And it's like, hey, this was worth it.
Is that an Oasis?
You call it Oasis. Hmm? The name of the business is Oasis.
Oh,
you call
it that. It's very confusing to people.
And you're always playing songs from Oasis.
And then you're always wondering why no one shows up. Because as people see it in the distance, they're like, no, don't go there. It's an Oasis.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you just killed your business.
Hey, everybody. Questions for next week.
Questions for
one
next week.
Yep. Is what's like a fact that's like, oh, I just learned that now. That's a neat fact. I want to tell you about it. Tell us that fact. Have you got a secondary question for the nice people? Your favorite Edgar Bergen puppet? Your favorite ventriloquist dummy?
That's right. We'll have that poll.
Yeah.
It's a Mortimer Snerd or Charlie McCarthy? There was a third one, right? Was there a third one? Or am I mixed
believe
up?
There was a third one. I keep mixing them up with, like, I always think, like, you know, the dog from Sherry Lewis, but that's not right.
Don't mix up the dog.
I had a friend who was in her last TV show. They shot that one here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was she okay then?
No. That was when she got kind of the final diagnosis.
Yeah, sad.
So they had to cancel the show because of that.
Yeah.
Sad. But apparently she was very, very sweet.
Sounds like she was a nice person, yeah.
Yeah. And Legally Blind.
Really?
Yep. Yep.
Huh.
Yeah, Lamb Chop, 2020 Vision. Weird. Like, how's that work?
Another question for next time. How about... I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
You can't think of anything
off the top? You got something loaded?
Sure. I'll say this then. What was your favorite puppet?
Favorite puppet?
Yeah, okay. It could be a Muppet. Could be a ventriloquist doll.
Okay.
Could be one you personally had.
Mm.
Yeah, who's your favorite puppet? And if you say a political character, you're like, I know.
Well, spitting image. You could name a spitting
image. Could be a spitting image thing. That's right. Or DC Follies.
DC Follies.
That's on the same level. I mean, it's Fred Willard. He's nice. I got to meet Fred Willard.
Okay.
On my one time going to Just for Laughs. And for that, I thank Just for Laughs, which longer exists.
Is it permanently finished now?
Well, they're bankrupt.
Oh, okay.
Morally.
That's weird. It's weird that it's bankrupt. Like, why?
Is it?
Why?
Bad management?
I guess that's what it was. But I mean, it's weird that they manage themselves so poorly that they've gone out of business.
I don't know.
Like, I guess they're relying on that
cigarette
money.
There's a giant function. I mean, the Aspen Comedy Festival is long gone.
Mm.
You know, what other comedy festival has lasted close to as long? Maybe the thing is that it's amazing. Yeah
It just seems weird. Like, I mean, it was such a big part, not just for Canadian comedians but for international comedians.
Sure.
American comedians. I mean, we had you know, Andy Kindler would do his state of the industry speech there.
Yep.
Every year. It was just hilarious. And yeah, it's just sad.
I agree. So hey, how you doing? bonus question. What's a festival that no longer is around that you liked that's no longer around? Let us know. I'll even take a festival that exists still. That's fine, too. My name is Ian.
I always liked Smoldering Man, but it's all over now.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know how to reach us, right? You go sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. That's our email, sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. You go to Facebook. We're there, Sneaky Dragon. You go to Tumblr, sneakydragon.tumblr.com. You go to X. Which used to be Twitter when it was better. That is sneaky_dragon. Or you can go to our website, sneakydragon.com. That's right. Not CA, not net, not gov. This is the actual Sneaky Dragon site. We got it early enough. That's how old we are. We got the com.
I'm sure the competition was knocking at the door trying to get that Sneaky Dragon name.
Anyway, there is a couple of Sneaky Dragon books that are out there, completely unrelated to us. But if you go there, you can post underneath any of the episodes in our message board area, or you can listen to any of our past podcasts, not just Sneaky Dragon podcasts, but other ones such as Totally Tintin, Completely Beatles, Full Marks, and the new ones that we got kicking around. Oh, Fansplainers. And new ones we got kicking around now, like Horse Mysteries and Refresh My Memory. On the most recent one, Tron.
Tron.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, and just a little apology to iTunes users, or I guess Apple Podcasts now users, that we had a bit of a snafu with linking from this website to Apple. So it's fixed.
Excellent.
It's working now. But yeah, it was weird because it was, you know, I when I post the show, you know, I post myself the email that goes out. If you are a subscriber, you can get the email that tells you when the show is out. And then also, I also have it on my phone so I can make sure that it's posted so that I can see it. And so it was there, and I was like, everything's just fine. And then the people writing to me and saying, I can't find it on Apple. So I apologize anyway.
Thanks for giving us the heads up.
It's one of those things. Yes, I really do appreciate that because I can't always see what's happening.
There you are. So listen, we'll be back here generally the same time next week. That's when we'll be here. Wherever you listen to the podcast, that's your business.
Yes, that's.
But you know, the earliest you'll be able to listen to it is generally the same time. Was the earliest time you could listen to it the previous week. That's the way this goes. But if you want to, we appreciate you coming by and spending a little time with us. That's darn decent of you. And I say it's spinach, and I say to hell with it. I'm Ian Boothby.
Oh, I'm David Dedrick.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Jeez.
It's falling apart here.
We've done this so many times.
We always do this ending.
We do. We start weak, we end weaker.
That's why it's called the weekly show.